You are now listening to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight, weekdays from 4:30 to 6, only on Eagle FM. Download the app or tune in to a frequency near you. Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM. And good afternoon, dear listeners. Obviously, welcoming you on this Monday. If you're going to wonder, why is Dwight happy? I'm not happy, guys. I'm always like this, you know. I'm mellow. I'm, going through the particular emotions of for today. And obviously also bringing you and developing the interesting conversations, discussions, topics that we always bring you here on The Home Run. Don't worry about Helmut. It's not like, you know, I sort of like bounced him off somewhere. He'll quickly just be joining us a few minutes later. But nonetheless, this is a new week. We are in the throes of what is a confusing particular winter here in Windhoek, specifically for us in the capital. The reason why I say it's confusing is because I always love giving case studies, stories, reference points, because that is how life should be. You highlight particularly things that you've observed, you've experienced, that thus also bring in the interesting conversation to, for example, you, our listeners and audience members out there. Now, one of the interesting things, obviously, that we've got lined up for today's discussion is we are looking at the June climate change meetings. I actually want to get the name properly, what the name is. So the climate change meetings in June, it happens every year in June. Let me ignore this particular thing. It happens every year in June. Yes, it's known as the climate meetings, the UN climate meetings. Now, this year it happened in Bonn, the city of Bonn, the German city of Bonn. And there was, a particularly interesting appeal that was highlighted, cited specifically by the Secretary General, Mr. Steele. I just want to cite his particular discussion also, where he highlighted primarily that the aim is not to drag out the negotiations and discussions about the climate change element that's happening around the world. If you don't know, there's another UN body known as the World Meteorological Agency, WMO, yeah. Organization, sorry, not agency. So the WMO, back in last month in June, highlighted that the occurrence of a very strong El Nino system later this year or in this year is going to be observed. Currently, right now, what you're looking at happening in the northern hemisphere of Namibia. And coincidentally, let me share this particular coincidence also with you, dear listeners. Coincidentally, I had to start another particular sort of like climate change workshop situation today. And obviously the people I am interacting with are fellow media representatives, and a lot of them primarily are now for the first time trying to understand what climate change is. And I've had my sort of like refreshers, introductions and so on, and also participating in the particular discussion beforehand, and obviously extensively here on Eagle FM for you and with you, as well as also bringing you the interesting discussions. And obviously when Helmut and I started presenting and co-hosting together here in The Home Run, we've obviously covered this discussion extensively. Now, it is interesting to hear from people who are getting like workshop training aspects on something that they don't usually look at. And this is a discussion that has been in the process for the better part of more than 10 years. And obviously, let me first, welcome my co-host, Helmut. How are you doing?
All good. I thought you were going to say, let's welcome our guest.
I almost said that. Yeah, I almost said I've become used to this first hour of our Mondays being occupied by Ulwazi, but yeah, you know, there was a slight change in today's particular plans.
Yeah.
But yeah, Helmut, just sort of like introducing our discussion for today, we're obviously looking at what were some of the major talking points coming out of the Bonn meetings. There is something interesting I sent to you on your way here. I want you to just look at like the headings of each one of them. Just the headings. Just look at the headings and who submitted them. Because you've got to look at each, because I'm going to cite some of them there.
Yeah.
In today's discussion.
Yeah.
But one of all these submissions took place before the meeting kicked off on 18 June.
Yeah.
So they had time to submit up until 17 June.
Yeah.
And on 18 June, the meeting starts off with Mr. Steele's live broadcasted message.
Yeah.
But before then, all concerned parties and stakeholders from around the world could submit a press release. Now, I want you to look at, there's one down there titled, "Not Our Solution."
Okay, so Thursday, 11th of June, 2026. Are those the submissions I'm looking at? I'm looking at titles and then the entities that submitted them.
Yeah,
I see the University of Leeds,
World Wildlife Fund.
Yeah, World Wildlife Fund. They submitted like two of them.
Yeah,
and they have planned for the Planet Foundation, Global Forest Coalition, or World Federation for Animals, and they submitted quite a lot of them. Now
the last one, also by the Global Forest Coalition, who submitted two. No, yeah, they submitted two. Yeah, read that last one.
Okay, out of the two submissions made by World Wildlife Foundation.
Okay. No, Global Forest.
Global Forest Foundation. Global Forest Foundation, press release, first UN Paris Agreement, high integrity carbon credit linked to Myanmar junta new reports.
No, the last one.
Yeah, that was on the 11th of June.
Yeah, last one.
The 11th, the one on the 8th of June.
Still in 11.
Okay, still on the 11th. Okay, the last one will be, "Not Our Solution, Global South Civil Society Rejects Geoengineering."
I mean, these are conversations now.
Yeah.
Do you know what was the saddening thing, Helmut? I wrote an article about Mr. Steele's in last month's e-paper.
Yeah.
Immediately after that week of 18 June, I wrote an article for, I think, the next week. Steele obviously makes his points, but obviously it's always the UN point, and the UN obviously are the guys that always collect, like, in this context, I'll use the real life data and examples in order to do their reports, like the one about the water report. Remember the water report done by the UN university that we looked at 2 months ago?
Yeah.
Because they try and look at realities on the ground. When we get to certain particular things, even like some NGO and civil society organizations around the world, I'm not talking about Namibian NGOs and Namibian civil society guys. Please don't misunderstand me. But they have been also known, for example, for like skewing a picture in terms of driving a narrative. And obviously in our scenario, being radio presenters and radio journalists, we've got to stay on the objective path, meaning observe what's the information, who's saying what, is there any other information that sort of like tries to counter this particular discussion? And we have that conversation here on air.
Yeah.
Now, when I look through some of these submissions that were given, which are all press releases, the best one out of here, the University of Leeds, that on 11 June. Another one is obviously the World Wildlife Foundation's guys, because they broke it up into various scenarios. I mean, they even got to know that COP31 is going to be a combination by two countries, one in the Global South, one who is technically part of the Global South in a way, but is part of NATO.
Technically can be a little confusing.
And is in Europe, that's Turkey.
Europe or Middle East.
Global
South, Global North.
They're also playing a pivotal part specifically like in the Middle East stabilization function.
Yeah.
That's Turkey, obviously. So the kinds of countries hosting and participate. Look, Helmut, up until UAE, and then was it Azerbaijan last year? Baku.
No, Baku was the year before that. Last year was Brazil.
So major oil and gas producing countries were hosting, which includes also Scotland, the UK, were hosting Egypt, Sharm el-Sheikh, where President Geingob famously went and signed that MOU with Ursula von der Leyen, which we, the Namibian media, did not see. I had to go and scratch out that video. I'm telling you, I had to go scratch out that thing, and I found it on an obscure European Facebook page thing there. You know, it was just, if I didn't Google search it, you would not easily find it. Then there was Glasgow 2021, 2022 was Sharm el-Sheikh, 2023 was Qatar. Qatar the dodgy one?
You're looking at Glasgow, Egypt, Qatar, Azerbaijan,
and Brazil last year.
Yeah.
2024 was where President Mbumba went to. No, he didn't go. He sent Minister Shifeta. 2024, because he went to Pact of the Forum of the Future and the UN General Assembly, which happened before that. Mm-hmm. And then we had the elections, obviously, in November.
In November, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. That's how things flowed there. So, if we look at this now, it has been major oil producing countries, Helmut, since 2021 that had been hosting the Conference of Parties engagements. And later this year, it'll be two more oil and gas producing countries. Both Australia and Turkey are major commodity producers, and specifically oil and gas. Australia produces so much gas, coal, and oil, Helmut. Yeah. Let me just stop there. This conversation, you can see this conversation won't be something that actually tackles the immediate concerning aspects. Reason being is you continuously can envisage, because Namibia is also going to be in part of that thing. And this is where the messaging prior to the current administration, I was always trying to find out. For example, when the Ukraine conflict kicked off, and when we announced the Green Hydrogen Strategy in 2021, I asked at that media briefings that President Geingob held at State House, what are we saying?
Dwight, most of these conversations that I had on a global stage, you know, supposedly to represent all countries, especially UN member states, most of these discussions have one major problem. Most of them have been, most of them have been heavily criticized for being one-sided. Remember the GMO discussion that we had last time?
Yeah. The one of last month.
The one where it was supposed to implement a genetic modification in agriculture, practice, especially crop farming, to boost the strength of species of the of the selective species of plants that we produce, so that they can survive the growingly harsh environment that seems to be popping up with time. Here's the problem. One thing that was very true that was pointed out in those reports is that most of the research for genetic modification to combat climate change that is available today, most of that research is based in the global north.
Yeah.
The research was done in the global north.
Yeah.
Now, much of it is basically based on a science experiment tailored for the terrain, environment, and atmosphere that you find in the global north. So that means we don't know how it's going to be effective, if we just, do all this research in the global north and then conclude that, you know what, this can work, for everyone. And then you put up this mass rollout. And then you realize that, the global south have a whole different type of terrain and environment.
Yeah, and that's why I showed you that press release.
Oh, no.
The one with the logo.
The second page. Not the second page. The second paragraph sums it up.
I like it how we, as the global south, now we know how to get straight to the point by saying, yeah, but we didn't cause this mess.
This is part of the problem, because now just look at we have to use science. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's okay. Science has advanced. Would be very naive or more like just a flat out stupid to not adopt it to try and solve the problems that we're facing, and those ones including, you know, climate change in general.
Yeah.
And this is climate change, whether it's in terms of energy transition or you know, just all across the board, or the way that we practice agriculture, you know, and all that. And transport is a significant part of it, because everything that we have to transport, everything that we have to produce, it's, you know, the idea, at least on a national level, is to produce it on a commercial level. Now, commercial means for sale. So you have multiple, you know, available markets that you like to sell the products to. That's where shipping comes in, which is why, a few weeks ago we had the discussion that also came out, you know, also was that, coming out of the UN, where they were looking at, all other modes of transport, like, you know, especially cars and rail and all these things, are transitioning from the fossil fuel into the green or renewable sources of energy.
Yeah.
How far are we in doing the same thing in the shipping industry, especially a cargo shipping?
Yeah.
So that discussion means, as countries, the idea is to produce something on a large scale to sell to different markets to boost our economy. So, when you look at it that way, you begin to realize that, we have to use science.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can't go around. We have to use science. But, how the science is used and what type of science is used is more often, dictated by, by the terms and conditions, for the most part, coming out of the global north. Because they have the intellectual property, they have the research and development, they have the finance to finance any type of basically energy transition programs that's being done, which are more often reasonably on a large scale.
Mm.
Now, when you talk about using science as part of energy transition or part of environmental protection or climate change mitigation strategies, it's not rocket science, except I don't think we are on the same page with regards to how to apply the science or how to roll it out. This is one of those reasons why, why my very, my favorite and very controversial Cameroonian businessman, NJI, pointed out that, look, we can't look, if you have to ask Africa to carry out an energy transition, you have got to ask them to, and allow them to do that energy transition on their economic pace. Mm. You can't expect Namibia and Switzerland to adopt the same climate change mitigation strategies. Switzerland is light years ahead economically. We are nowhere near.
Yep.
So we're going to need time and resources to invest in that energy transition, or which will then power our industries for us to grow to the level where everyone is taken care of. So it would be very unfair for everyone who is who seem to have sorted out everything economically in their country, which is most part of the global of the global north, to ask countries that are in the global south to adopt things just instantly on the same level that they are. Like the document that you just shared, and the very, the part that you just pointed out to me. This seems to me like this was a response that these guys got from countries coming out of the global south. Not our solution. Mm. Now that for me sounds like a solution was cooked up in the global north, and it was just shoved in the throats of the countries in the global south. And the problem with the global south is that we are very good at coming up with plans on the paper, but more often we don't have the finance to fund those plans to get them off the ground. So, which I think is more often the problem with the global south, because the global north then will be like, you know what, we'll just come up with all the plans and then fund the plans that, that are in our favor. This, again, for the millionth time, is the same problem that AfriExim Bank And I believe African Development Bank. This is the reason why they decided to deviate from, you know, from the international financial institutions in terms of energy transition financing to come up with the Africa Energy Funding. The reason they gave was, African countries are still sort of like in crawling stage in terms of development, industrial wise. Now, you know, countries in the global north are telling us that we have to, you know, we can only access energy financing in terms of the, you know, infrastructure of, you know, of industrial energy, basically energy sources.
Yeah.
We can finance, you know, we can access funding for finance, to finance our energy projects as long as these projects are renewable and climate change friendly. Now, that means anyone that would like to invest into non-green or more like non-renewable source of energy like fossil fuel, they had a problem accessing that financing.
Yeah.
So the African Bank guys, well, you know, so I mean, looked at that in, as something that was unfair, which it, you can argue that it was.
It will be unfair, Helmut, but here's also the concern. If you and this has been the concern from the like decolonization argument,
yeah,
the, you know, many Pan-Africanists love throwing that argument around, but if you tell them now, will you stop using money? Which, because money is a concept from that was brought to us.
No, you won't.
Yeah. Will you stop driving your BMW? No, you won't.
No, we're still shopping for them.
Yeah. Will you stop going to your favorite mall here in Windhoek? No, you won't, because you will definitely still support that whole particular business model.
Yeah.
Now, at the heart of this, we can clearly identify consumerism feeds
at the
in,
center of it.
At the center of the global climate change.
Yeah.
Because when you look at microplastics, it's from consumer retail products. If you look at even something like fishing, overfishing,
yeah,
it's from the consumer retail perspective. Cement used for building bricks and stuff, it's because people need homes. And what is supported? Brick and mortar homes. If you look at the petrochemical sector, mm-hmm, it's because we've got, like, we look at the studio now. Everything here in front of us is plastic.
Yep.
There's a lot of plastic in the studio.
Good luck getting rid of that.
And what does it feed from? Those cameras, these cameras that we've got here, my mobile phone, this tablet, this pen, my mouse in front of me, everything in front of us
surrounded by plastic.
Is just plastic.
Yeah.
And where does plastic come from? Because yes, you can find plastic from two sources, but the most, the one that brings down the economies of scale the quickest is from the petrochemical side, because they realized they could get the plastic from there. Plastic was formerly made from three other chemicals, that were put together. But now they obviously realize that petrochemicals helps to achieve the plastic proliferation a lot quicker.
Yeah.
Now, the decolonization argument is one that doesn't make sense in the broader scheme of anything, because you immediately have to go and look at the economic sphere of things, right?
Yeah.
When you start from the economics of things, specifically in the decolonization argument from the Pan-African political sphere,
yeah,
they won't give up money because they know their money will still be inferior to the four major central banks of the world,
yeah,
that I mentioned. Unless you do a Russia, not the decoupling and the ring fencing and the ice, you know, to make sure that you are sanctions resilient. I'm talking about that thing that Russia signed with the former USSR satellite states, the Commonwealth of Independent Nations, or Commonwealth of Independent Countries, the CIC. And with the Commonwealth of Independent Countries, which not many people speak about, is there's a common customs union and a common market template between Russia, Belarus. Ukraine was part of it, because Ukraine is one of the founding members alongside Belarus and Russia.
Yeah.
Kazakhstan and all the other stans, and Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan, and there's one I'm missing. What's that? It's Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan. What's that other country's name? Man. How can I forget them? Because I always forget this guy. Tajikistan, yes, and Tajikistan. These four countries, alongside Moldova, Ukraine, Russia and Belarus. These cluster of countries have a common economic policy between each other, meaning they technically ring-fenced, Helmut, their currencies to not be dramatically exposed to global
shocks.
Yeah, but global financial shocks primarily.
Yeah.
So they know what to do. They know how to act. Now, nowhere have I even seen on the SADC level, on the SADC level of acting or functioning in such a scenario. Because, Helmut, the thing that happens then between those countries is that it's not just the ruble, it's not just the Belarusian currency, it's not just the Ukrainian currency, it was not just the other guys and their currencies. Everyone's currency is interchangeable with everyone else's currency. So if you walk with Namibian dollars across the border, you can go and use Namibian dollars there. And if the South African can comes here, like they're now currently doing, they can use their money here. But because we were technically lazy as Namibia, and we decided, okay, let's just peg to South Africa. We just pegged. But when you go look at the CIC discussion, they've got a common economic policy between all these member nations for the CIC. And they basically told each other, listen, we've got to be resilient for ourselves. We've got to provide for ourselves. We can't wait on just the Western nations of Europe to be continuously consuming. And we can't just expect everybody to buy everything that we have. Because technically, you are almost a country on yourself with your own sovereign, with your own sovereign identity, with your own sovereign needs, with your own sovereign particular goals. Now, if you bridge into this particular discussion that we are looking at, the climate meetings that happened, or the climate meeting that happened. Now, there's a funny abbreviation they love using in the discussion, which is the SBSTA64 and the SBI64, which are known as the subsidiary bodies for scientific technology and technological advice. That's SBTA. And the SBI is subsidiary bodies. The 64 indicates the 64th session where this climate meetings took place. Now, here's the interesting thing, guys. Oh, yeah, I was still on the story at the start of this discussion before you stepped in, Helmut. So, I explained to, because I had to start another workshop today, which I was parachuted in. But anyway, besides the parachuting. So, I explained now earlier today to the other members of this particular engagement, because I explained to the one guy, now they are now busy spitballing, you know, how to do ideas for storytelling and stuff like that. And I can immediately see where to start from, you know, because one person would say, hey, people in the rural area don't understand why they're receiving lesser rainfall this year.
Yeah,
I would immediately say, okay, go talk to Ministry of Works and Transport for the meteorological office. Otherwise, because I know where to go, I would just immediately access the World Meteorological Organization, which is a UN agency's reports, and I would know beforehand, okay, Southern Africa could potentially see lessened rainfall from October heading to May. That's our rainfall.
Yeah.
I would be able to read that. But this is now for a new batch of people that are sitting there primarily who don't think like Dwight. Who have not trained him or herself to think that way as well, to go like, okay, so there is a global organization. They definitely have reports. They definitely do showcasing of snippets per month about changing weather patterns and atmospheric pressure patterns. What are we looking at? Not everybody thinks that way. So I identified with the one guy. I told him, okay, do you guys know that Namibia and Botswana are technically 2 degrees Celsius warmer than any part of the world, automatically. And then even the facilitator went like, are you sure, Dwight? I said, yes. Now, these global climate meeting, this thing that took place last month in Bonn, Germany, it's headed by the same agency, primarily that collects those IPCC, that's affiliated to the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, which housed that report where I saw that particular statement. Primarily because they have access to scientists that are submitting these reports to a UN level. It's not submitted through the Ministry of Environment here in Windhoek. No. The IPCC goes and talks to independent people on the ground, like the rapporteur discussion that we had last week.
Yeah.
Like Francesca Albanese.
Yeah.
She's an independent person. She's a specialist.
Yeah.
So they access a specialist directly and they tell the specialist, listen, you are contracted. Yes, there's a salary that you're getting because you're not working for free. So please go.
We just want an independent third party point of view on the research that we're doing.
Exactly. So here's the hypothesis. Here's the particular problem for you to focus on. Please go and investigate, report, compile your report and submit, please. Straightforward stuff. Now, not many people know about these actual hubs, Helmut, that contain all these information sets. And when I show up, for example, like that workshop that I went to earlier today, I feel a little bit bad, primarily because I'm sitting there like the library. You know, it's like Google going to a training workshop for search engines. Now, I said that Dwight is just going like, your mind is like active like this the whole time, but you're sitting like going like, yeah, man, toch man. Why was I dropped here? Why was I told to come here?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Obviously, that is still to see outcomes. Now, one of the particular things, now this is, I didn't want to look at the EU Commission website, but if you go and try and look for what was the outcome of these climate meetings, the EU Commission had an article on 23 June, just a couple of days after the meetings ended, where the main focus was the practical action and the identification of areas where further progress is needed ahead of end of this year.
Oh boy.
I thought the practical action was to operationalize the loss and damage fund. Remember when we looked at it last year?
Yeah.
It was, everyone kept saying, loss and damage. We don't want privately operated wealth funds that the UAE that Qatar went and established. We don't want wealth funds. Yes, we want actual government or government-run or government-peer-administered loss and damage fund facilities. A facility that pays out if there's a disaster, a natural disaster in your country. Not a facility that is managed like someone's BlackRock or someone's
Vanguard.
Vanguard or Old Mutual Wealth facility here in the... No, not something like that. It must be a government-to-government peer-administered function. You and I know what's the answer to that.
Look, if you look at the way that multinational corporations have been set out to operate, and I think the Ford and Dodge case of 1919, that case laid a terrible foundation on how private companies are operated.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, just like everything else, it came with its own pros and cons.
Yeah.
So you are not going to have something that's just going to have positivity without any negative, without any negative side. The case was very simple. The Dodge brothers, the founders of the brand Dodge, the car. Now, they sued, Ford, Henry Ford, because he wanted to use some of the money, that accumulated as part of the profit for the company that year to increase, the salary of his employees. Now, the Dodge brothers said at this time, they were in the early days of founding their company.
Mm.
So, this is why it's more often debated as to, did Henry Ford want to do that because he felt pity for the employees, or it was just a creative way for him to, you know, to kill off the competition that was emerging? Because he had a near, if not just a flat-out monopoly in terms of car manufacturing at the time. Mm. So the shareholders, the Dodge brothers, they being the shareholders at the time, they took Ford to court and in Michigan. The court ruled that, okay, you know what? It doesn't matter how much money in terms of profit, in terms of return, a company makes. No matter how high it is, even if you have increased as high as the ionosphere, the shareholders, shareholder dividends, if the company is making money, just keep giving the money to the shareholders, because they are the priority. And the cost reasoning was very, was very understandable, that the shareholders are the ones that are carrying the risk. Yeah, so therefore, the employees are not, they are not the priority.
Yeah.
The priority is the shareholders.
Yeah.
So now, since then, the model of a private entity has been has basically been run on that on that principle. So now what you have is every private entity prioritizes shareholders, reasonably so, because it's the it's the shareholders that are putting money into this venture. In other words, if it goes belly up, they're the ones that stands the most to the most to lose in terms of investment.
Yeah.
Now the decision that was made was it doesn't matter how much money in terms of profit your company makes, just give the shareholders their worth because they are carrying the risk.
Mm.
Since then, what you have seen is a very simple, reasonable court judgment that have been turned into, capitalism, which is very cutthroat as we see it today. Now, what you have is, you now live in a situation, and this is very prevalent in the Western world, where you have CEOs that are flying private, but their employees can barely afford bread. Because, they're also paid in stock.
Mm.
So they are well compensated as long as they just keep, pushing all these unorthodox ways of practicing business, which is why you have, cases in the U.S. of private prisons taking the government to court because they failed to meet their incarceration quotas. So because it's diabolical.
Yeah, and it's in the contract.
it is in the contract which you signed. So it's not their fault they are suing you. You should have read before signing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you look at it like that, you can actually understand why a lot of people would rather, prefer having, institutions, institutions that, that has to do with large scale dispensation of any benefits in the public sector rather than in the private sector. Now ask yourself, just how bad are you? Because the public sectors the world over have been known, in many countries, including ours,
yeah,
have been known to be secondary in terms of service or product provision compared to the private sector. The private sector has been known to always be at the top of their game. Now, when you are at the top of your game in terms of of dispensing the product or services that you, of the business that you find yourself in,
mm,
when you are at the top of your game in that department, and people still prefer the side, in this case, the public sector that is just known to have a bunch of things falling apart, they will, these are the people basically saying, would rather these benefits be dispensed by the side that is known to be terrible at dispensing it than you who is known to be good at it.
Mm.
That's because, we have just come to realize that once you privatize something, the individuals that service or that product is dispensed to become secondary. The shareholder becomes primary.
Yeah.
It's not the CEO or the, it's not the CEO's fault or the manager's fault or the director's fault. It's the, it's the principle the model is laid on.
Mm.
It's the foundation it's laid on. It's basically built to run more in favor of shareholders than anyone else. So when they say, thank you very much, Qatar, for coming up with that whole brilliant idea, but privatizing it, we are not backing you up on that. Make it public.
But yeah,
The second paragraph on the Global South. Now,
the response to ways that we can basically fix the environment so that we don't all, you know, turn into, yeah, well, popcorn.
Or do you think we'll be the frog casually just enjoying the increasing temperature in the water?
When you're being cooked, literally being cooked. Here's it. Speakers, this is according to the Global Forest Coalition, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Speakers from across the Global South warned that geoengineering, which is the large-scale technological intervention designed to manipulate the Earth system, is being advanced despite the profound ecological, social, and geopolitical risks. Rather than addressing the root cause of climate crisis, these approaches enable business to continue as usual. And that geoengineering is basically a large scale think of it like, let's plant more trees to upset the carbon. Or let's all shift, which is exactly what we're doing, and also advocating for. The entire 2015 Paris Agreements are built on that foundation, yeah, of let's shift as much industries from non-renewable to renewable sources of energy as much as we can. You're talking about industries as a whole, to to transport, to cooking, you name it. Now, these approaches, like let's plant more trees and from planting more trees, that's where the whole idea, I think, of carbon offsetting comes in. You know what a bunch of rich countries and rich companies have done? They're using the carbon offset, using a lot of money they have. Mm. They are now buying forests that are natural in other countries, and then using that as an excuse to continue using fuels that we are supposed to be transitioning from.
Yeah.
So the Global South countries on these ones, they are right. We are not addressing the root cause. Instead of allowing a multinational company or a rich country to tell you that, I'm driving a fleet of trucks that are running on diesel here, and I'm not looking forward to transitioning from this to anything anytime soon. Because the carbon dioxide being produced by my trucks is being offset by 500 square kilometers of land somewhere in Africa,
like what happened in Zimbabwe, the forest that was purchased by Qatar.
I think it was Zimbabwe, Tanzania, Malawi.
I think there's a Zambian one also.
Yeah, Blue Carbon did that.
Yeah.
Now, I think. I can factor in the blue carbon purchasing of land,
yeah,
as one of those things that the Global South are referring to here. They're saying that we are not addressing the root cause here.
Yeah.
Because by not addressing the root cause, and I'm glad they pointed that out, by not addressing the root cause, we are allowing the industries who are supposed to be transitioning to operate business as usual. Because if I have a forest, because if I manage to cook up an idea, which is basically the whole thing is cooked up, if I manage to tell everyone that I'm, my fleet of trucks here, the carbon dioxide they're producing is being offset by a forest of land I bought in Azerbaijan.
Mm. So now,
so that means my trucks will just keep running. Carbon dioxide is still going in there, I will tell you I'm participating in energy transition. Really?
And you will still buy your annual or monthly diesel for your fleet.
Exactly.
The what's that thing? The grease needed to grease?
Yeah, the lubricants.
Okay, that one. It's grease and oil, engine oil.
You didn't have to make it, meh.
You went for lubricant, which is both correct. They're both correct. But yeah. it's a dimension, Helmut, that just have to remember to look left sometimes. It's
real bad, man.
You guys shouldn't have heard that, but yeah. Okay, you guys didn't hear it. Anyway, yeah. But yeah. So when we obviously look at this dimension, I've been trying to open up a specific report. No, it's my side. So when we have to look at this particular conversation, obviously of these reports of the climate meeting itself, I'm slightly not happy to not see anything else beside the, you know, the speech of Mr. Steele from the UN climate dimension, and plus also the intergovernmental panel on climate change, guys. They're also not, you know, they've got their whole bunch of reports and stuff, and they went and changed their website again. There was this lovely thing, Helmut, where they showed the impacts per region, per country. Like, you had Southern Africa that had an analysis. It's a, I've been going through this thing the whole day, and it's just, it's for someone else. It's not the way I remember the report itself or the website itself. So now I have to find that report from the get-go.
I think the word you're looking for is Dear Makar.
It is Dear Makar, but it's an organized Dear Makar. Look how nice it is. It's an organized Dear Makar. Look there. So, you know, it looks nice. It looks inviting to getting, you know,
touch. I read more.
Yeah. So, on the indication, obviously, Europe says here, Europe, which is currently financing the particular just energy transition in the global south.
Yeah.
Obviously through the Samoa Agreement, just so that you guys know, I'm just re-jogging your memory. We are obviously into the second half of the year, which has been, if you don't know, on the home run, we do this a lot. We wait for things to get to the midway point of the year. And then the midway point of the year technically leads us into the UN General Assembly, which is where the climate discussions also will be championed. It'll lead into other particular multilateral platforms, as well as also the next conference of parties, as well as also later this year, Helmut, is going to be another desertification conference. The last one happened was in 2024, where I observed that...
That was the 16th one.
Yeah, the one that took place in Saudi Arabia, where I observed that Minister Shifeta basically had almost the same speech. He was at the Conference of Parties, and he was in Saudi Arabia, and he almost had the same... Because I wanted to know, what did our minister... Was there someone from Namibia? What did this person say? And then I saw it was him on both scenarios.
Shifeta was just like, you know what, it's both about climate change.
Yeah, and...
I, you know, I don't have time for this.
And for the love of everything good in this world, start the loss and damage fund, which is a good idea. It'll help Namibia a lot, the loss and damage, because... I'm still on story time.
Mm-hmm.
Not many people know of geography.
What do you mean?
As the subject. We saw geography in high school.
Uh-huh.
We ignored geography in its lessons. In real life, people ignore the geography. I've come to this massive humdinger of a light bulb moment in reality. You know what will help explain a lot of things in this country, like flash floods, the impact of flash floods in informal settlements?
Yeah.
Because how can you say... for example, a local authority is not doing their job if you were the one building your kambashu in the riverbed or in a, what's that other thing? A flood prone area.
Like in a ditch?
Well, it can be. Well, if you look at Windhoek specifically, Windhoek has got a lot of ups and downs. So there's a lot of places for surface water to run.
Elevated areas, and you have just flat out valleys.
Yeah. And a lot of those areas, basically the water runs down to gather at the bottom. Because as one hydrologist or water specialist once said one time in a movie, water finds the easiest path. And water is gravitational. It'll flow down.
Yeah.
Unless you are the Nile. That's a different discussion on geography. Unless you are the Nile... It's a completely different discussion on geography. However, conventionally, water finds the easiest path to flow.
Yeah.
Now, also, a second thing. I only found out last year that when the north floods from those water, that flows in from Angola, from southern Angola, it's actually water from the Congo Basin. It's rainforest rainfall.
So it's just a series of cascading rainfalls.
Surface water just flowing through Angola and Zambia into the Okavango Delta in Botswana and into northern Namibia.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, I've looked up, the satellite image of Angola. Now, the thing is, Angola has a lot of rivers.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now, and it's also, well, it's, you know, a large chunk of it is basically, now if you look at Namibia's rainfall, you know, rainfall statistics, the northern regions receive more rainfall than the southern regions.
Yeah.
That's just Namibia. Now, the terrain of southern Namibia, the terrain of northern Namibia how do I put this? The rain that Namibia receives in the northern part, what we call, you know, the highest rainfall in the country, more often, is the least rainfall in Angola. In a way that rainfall is recorded in Angola.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the terrain, the terrain of Angola, the more north you look, the more north you go, the more green it gets.
Becomes.
Yeah. So that means the more green.
Why is everything written in Russian?
Don't start.
I just had to ask that question. Because I saw Zambia's name and I saw Russian. I'm like, who called Helmut? Why did Helmut do this?
You know, just decided to, the whole, phone settings.
Yeah.
Now, the river, like, I like to do this thing where I'll just go on Google Maps and then switch to satellite view and then just pick a body of water. And I've done this with both the Orange River and the Zambezi River.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just like to, to follow it, to sort of like see where it is coming from. The Kavango River will take you straight into Angola. And then you realize that, parts of central Angola, as especially central as you go from central to east.
To DRC Zambia,
DRC Zambia.
Yeah.
It's a very mountainous and a very, it's a very mountainous place with a lot of, of rivers that are merging and splitting. So as you can imagine, DRC is in the rainforest.
Yeah.
When the rain is falling there, it doesn't take a lot of rainfall, for these bodies of water to basically pick up all that rainfall that's coming from there, and then combine it with the already flowing water, and that becomes a little bit of a nightmare for northern Namibia.
Helmut, when you say not a lot of rainfall, please, for a Namibian, whatever falls in DRC, is definitely a lot more than what Namibia gets on average.
It is a lot. I mean, DRC is a whole different ball game.
I mean, even when you look at, look at all these floodplains in Angola.
There are a lot.
I mean, this is a lot.
They are a lot. I mean, when you look at it from where the water is coming from, like you pointed out, look at it as from DRC through Angola into northern Namibia.
Yeah.
If it's flowing through, and Angola by landmass is huge.
Yeah.
So if the water is flowing from DRC through Angola, that's a lot of rain.
Yeah. And this technically means, obviously, also, what's that thing that they've got in Asia? The monsoon season.
Uh-huh.
Now, the monsoon season is now something which is used to the benefit of agriculture, specifically in Asia, where it's a lot of rainfall. It's like rain on tap a lot of times.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of rainfall, ultimately, that helps to feed the agricultural sector of those Southeast Asian countries, and also China to great length, and also other particular countries like India,
mm-hmm.
Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, you name it. Now, and our concern has been always, do you allow this water to freely just flow, once again putting infrastructure and lives at risk?
Yeah.
For example, like in a Namibian context. Because remember back in 2023, Helmut, what was the thing that Minister Schlettwein, when he was Minister of Agriculture, said at the time? Was people were asking, why does the water just show up doesn't the government have any early warning systems?
Oh, yeah.
And then the ministry went and did their investigation, came back and said, well, it's because some people destroyed the early warning systems. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, how do you destroy early warning systems? What kind of Namibians do we have? What kind of citizens do we have? Why do they do the most ridiculous things? They damage or impact infrastructure that's supposed to be there for us all, ne?
I think it's a lot of factors, including, you know, I need to get high. Now, because when you look at it from...
at least someone, it's 5 o'clock.
Look, man. There was this time when it became, more and more frequent water pumps being stolen in the Kavango regions.
Yeah.
Yeah, remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not just Kavango. It also happened as you move westwards into the other O regions.
You see, the thing is, you hustle, you get your $100, you use $60 of that to connect to Superhighway to call an Eagle FM and complain about your animals not having enough water.
Or you can't pump the water.
You can't pump the water. Yeah. So the government shows up with a solution. And, someone in that very same, community
decides to monopolize.
the
infrastructure.
Someone hustled to work with the ministry of, agriculture or NGOs or any entity that, that basically came in to help them, set up that water pump. And, someone in that very same community is working against the efforts of more often the majority that would like to, to give water access to the animals and basically everyone, including their people. So, I'll go with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now
you are proposing a solution, and when you call all these meetings, I'm attending those meetings. When the solution comes and water pump is being set up and there is inauguration and all these things being done, I am there. When everyone goes to bed, I go back and steal the thing
and decide to switch it on only when my animals have to come and drink water. Do you know what is one of the interesting things, Amut, that also fits into that story of yours? The same person that I know from on the other side of Karasburg, there's a communal land board and a communal land setting known as SATCO there in the Karas region, and she told us the story that there was a resettlement farmer right next. It's the resettlement farmer. He's a guy from the community. He applied to the Ministry of Agriculture for a resettlement farm. He got the resettlement farm. Now he's right next door to them. And he part of his particular sort of like infrastructure, renovation and revamping exercise was buying 2 solar powered pumps for the borehole.
Yeah.
So he had a spare pump in storage. And then he decided, because this communal land community, they probably also need a pump, because the windmill.
Yeah.
The windmill that administered that powered the pump was broken. And no one in the community took up the idea to try and fix the windmill and its pump. So this guy donated his spare solar powered pump to the community. So that pump lasted there for a year, because then his solar power pump, the one that was busy working, broke down.
Yeah.
And then he came back and asked for this one that he installed this side.
Yeah.
And so the community was once again left without a pump to pump water. Now I'll leave it there, Helmut, because the person was obviously complaining about this current situation to my sister and I, and we stood there looking at her going like, and none of you guys decided to fix the original pump. And
so they became comfortable.
Basically, yes. The moment that there's free infrastructure brought to a community,
you're supposed to be working on your old one.
But this is what I've seen in Namibia. Yeah. The moment free infrastructure is brought to a community in Namibia, it's not like they move past that burden to try and then focus on improving other things. Or, you know, now you've got the solar pump.
Yeah.
Try fixing the original pump. so that you give the man his solar pump back.
Yeah.
Because that solar pump won't also last forever with you.
No.
It won't last for another 100. No. Because if you look at the mechanical pump that you had, no, not mechanical, wrong word. The pump that you had that was wind powered, Nochos, that's a green solution.
Yeah, it is.
It's a green solution.
Yeah,
because the solar powered pump.
Yeah, as long as you're talking about a solar powered windmill.
Yeah, because the solar powered pump, ne, is not green. Because the solar panel is made from.
You have to mine that whole thing.
Exactly.
But when you look at that level of technicality, even a windmill, you know, the mechanical part that rotates, it needs lubricants.
And we're not talking about cooking oil, ne?
Cooking oil is terrible for lubrication.
There was a lady the other day that said, I was talking about something that needed grease, needed lubrication, but it was a mechanical part.
Yeah.
And then she says, just, you know, off the cuff of her head,
yeah,
use sunflower oil. I looked at her and I was like,
you gotta be kidding me.
Sunflower oil? Really, lady? Sunflower oil is your suggestion?
You can't lubricate anything with sunflower oil.
And when she said this, I was like, you do know that that doesn't work, right? This is something else. It's not supposed to be putting on a film of plastic. You're supposed to grease the thing properly. So yeah, lubricants obviously still need to stay a mainstay specifically for anything that you have made of iron, whether it's machines to just moving parts to just, you know, things rubbing against each other. We won't expand on that particular idea because we won't.
You're becoming worse, man. I go, where's that?
Hey, look, you.
You took us
somewhere very quickly, but yeah. I won't share also today's joke that I had with my group member at that workshop because it's even more a little bit pun scary.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So. It's because both our names start with the same letter.
Okay, I'll leave it there. I <yeah. laughs>
Both our names start with the same letter. So she made the joke. Let me be safe and say she made the joke. I didn't make the joke.
You're implicated.
Funny thing it was all the women that caught onto the joke very quickly. No men did. I was the only guy that laughed. So yeah. So as we obviously look at this discussion, we'll quickly be taking a short break, just in a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
But just to highlight some of the particular talking points. Now, we were still obviously on the aspect of how the climate change discussion and geoengineering from that one specific press release from the coalition guys those Global South guys,
mm-hmm,
who basically and I mean the Global Forest Coalition is a pretty interesting civil society component itself. The key thing, obviously, is, for example, what is the outcome that should be achieved? Yes, one of these NGOs that are active in Namibia through local representation is, for example, like the World Wildlife Fund. There is a World Wildlife Fund office in Namibia, but they obviously work through with various other particular non-governmental or non-profit organizations. For example, still requesting the fossil fuel phase out discussion. I mean, it's tricky. I mean, look at Namibia. Namibia is now happy, ne, Helmut, that there is interest for what's happening in Namibia. We are happy. And I am quoting technically what the civil society Namibians are saying.
And look, I know we are happy, but when it comes to climate change, that's one of those discussions we are having in a lukewarm type of state.
You call that lukewarm, or you call that absent-mindedness?
Look, man, we have look. I'll defend us here. it's not our fault.
Yeah.
Both our green, both our green initiatives being invested in this country, and our non-green energy sources investment being done, it's heavily carried by the global north.
Yeah.
Financially, if you look at the oil and gas is dominated by American and Western European countries. And the green hydrogen, Western Europe. Now, both of them, these are the adults that are supposed to be carrying, according to the 2015 Paris Agreement, they're supposed to be carrying us into, as a developing country, into the energy investment. Like, energy transition.
Yeah.
You know what, let's move away from this. They are investing in something we are supposed to be moving away from. Well, I mean, there's a lot of money involved. What I was supposed to say, no. Of course not.
Yeah.
Well, you want to invest? We have the resources. You have the money. Well, yeah, go ahead. We'll just meet every year, at conference of parties and talk about all this type of, energy transition and all that, and then come back and say, now, are we ready for the final investment or not? Yeah, let's drill, baby, drill. By 2034, there we want to have it, in full swing and want to make money.
Definitely.
So this is where you see now this conflict between, which is very typical in pretty much all discussions being had by a bunch of politicians. What you have is what is being said is more often the complete opposite of what you see taking place on the ground practically.
Okay, there's another practicality. Mm. Okay, let me share this as well. So. Back in last week, no, not in last week, the week before. No, it wasn't last week. Yeah, it wasn't last week. No, it was the week before. I bumped into someone else from another media platform. And they asked me, so I'm talking about, is it the 1st of July? Yeah, that was on the 1st of July. I bumped into this person, they asked me, Dwight, are you coming with us to, it was literally the 10th, that week of the 10th of July.
Yeah.
Are you coming on this media trip to see a oil rig that Friday? I was like, an oil rig?
Hmm.
Where is this invite? I didn't see it. No, just go and check in. I'm like, and I sit there thinking to myself, as I'm done talking to this person, I sit there thinking to myself going like, what is the Namibian government up to? Why are we talking green transition, one side green industries? Oh, case in point. Next month is going to be the month of extractive industries, particular the conferences and expos, par excellence. Meaning there's going to be the oil and gas conference. Always in August.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be the mining expo. Always in August as well.
You know, one of the questions that I asked Franz that always made my head spin during my early days of being here at Eagle FM was, because every time that I looked at politics, I'm seeing what is being said is one thing, but the complete of what is being said is being done on the ground. So. So I asked, I remember asking Franz, why is politics like this? Because what is more often being said is not what's taking place on the ground. His response was simple, that in politics, it doesn't have to make sense. It just have to make money.
Which is true.
Yeah.
However, when you look to the global north, when you go to the global north,
yeah,
it's the opposite. I watched a discussion earlier this morning. It was the New York Times. The guy Ezra Klein, the journalist, he interviewed a former Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd. So Kevin, at the age of 59, after he lost an elections when he was still defending his role as Prime Minister, he decided to go and study to get a doctorate in philosophy on Xi Jinping.
On what now?
On China. And their current leader, Xi Jinping, Kevin Rudd. So I sat there thinking to myself, how does another international leader or former leader basically have a whole thesis on what's happening in China in terms of the economic direction and the political economy behind it influencing the particular industrial direction that China is taking.
Okay. A PhD.
Yeah, he's got a doctorate in this particular...
On Xi. I would be so proud.
It's a book. Yeah. It's literally a book. His PhD is literally a book. It's the same thing that...
I imagine the thesis is going to be that big.
It's the same thing that... what's the guy's name? My sister who has Zoran Mamdani's father's book, who's a political scientist, Mahmoud Mamdani. Mahmoud wrote a whole textbook, Helmut, that is prescribed in South Africa for political science.
That's his PhD thesis.
That was one of his theses. A textbook. Yeah, I'll just leave it
you're
like that.
You're complaining about assignments. five pages, man.
I'll just leave it like that.
I'm losing my sleep over five pages.
I'll just leave it at that so that you know the how we see, specifically in Namibia, regarding the research and development. You know, why is it taking so long for us to get in the research and development space as a country? Well, if there are other Africans that can write a textbook just like this at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
I mean, my two elder siblings made the joke when they started on Stellenbosch University in 1994, 1995, respectively. They made a joke of the one lecturer they had in like the, one of the begin, the first year classes, like introduction to law or Roman Dutch law, stuff like something like that.
Yeah.
Where the guy, the lecturer, and when he comes in for 5 minutes of the lesson, I'll say it again. He comes in for 5 minutes of the lesson. He says, for tomorrow's work, for tomorrow's classwork, go read in this page, go read in this page, go read in this textbook and that textbook. And then they realized that all the textbooks he was citing for them to go and read up on were books that he wrote that are in the university's library.
In other words, I would have taught you, but I've already written this down, so just go and read it.
So just go read the work that I wrote. Just go read the work that I wrote.
You know, I already wrote this thing. I don't have time for this.
Now, if you don't know what that sounds like, dear listeners,
that is the
highest level, the creme de la creme of potential corruption, because technically you're prescribing a book that you wrote that's in the library that you for the institution you are working for. But we'll leave it like that. That's 1994, 1995. You know, that's a different era. So, when we look at these kinds of things, the discourse always seems like the Global South doesn't actually have a major role to play. Where it is in some areas the Global South that has a core function to play, because we are the ones that ultimately will be driving the just energy transition discussion.
Yeah.
You just have to look at Namibia. Sorry, specifically, guys, where we will be producing green hydrogen for three major industrial economies. The European Union, potentially China, South Korea.
Yeah, most likely China.
Well, China will have a role to play in it, because primarily where China will play like a supply and a labor, a skill-based scenario. Like I said, when the president was last year at the Oshivela, whichever one of the two, High Iron Complex, the Nirongo region, when she pressed the button, the guy standing next to her, the technical guy standing next to the president, was from China. So, one of the main technical staff on site? Yeah, they are there. So, we obviously will see such things, becoming more and more obvious. With the current discourse in Namibia being about how do we participate in these functions. Now, last week we did the hydrogen review, right?
Yeah.
Because the hydrogen review is obviously that one particular major contributing factor in terms of hydrogen being the new fuel source. But yeah, I mean, it starts from there. Where they even identified that the technology will come from the global north to the global south, which actually coincides with this Forest Coalition guys by saying, it's not our solutions, guys.
Yeah,
we didn't think these things up.
Yeah, you are just, you know, telling us to do it, and because we don't have, you know, our own money to finance our own plans. But, okay, here's one thing that is not being pointed out. Look, I know that if you set a bunch of Global South nations, you know, countries representatives to point out, okay, you know what, this whole geoengineering is not your solution, you know. Carbon offsetting plan, more three is energy transition, especially in terms of transport. So let's just start small and then we can go big.
Yeah.
If this is not what your plan is in terms of energy transition, what do you propose? We would have a lot of things to say.
But
until the question comes, right, how do you plan on financing all these initiatives?
I wanted to get there, but there's a question before that question of the financing.
Yeah.
The question being, do you even know what's happening in the Earth's atmosphere?
Well, we have a brain drain. You have a bunch of people with a lot of PhDs. But the thing is, what you have is...
Why did you do that, Helmut? Why did you do that?
So I would assume looking at just how many people have advanced, you know, more and more people getting advanced degrees and more people again, you know, being interviewed who are experts on pretty much everything, Africa, economic, political, you know, agriculture, world, social science, you name it. Most of the people that are being interviewed to tell a story of, you know, of the state of any of these, you know, of affairs in any of these disciplines are being, you know, are Africans, black, being interviewed out of the global north.
Yeah.
So, I would say they know when it comes to knowledge. But, I think this is where you have this, collision now. One, like you more often point out, a lot of people that, you know, that have, the knowledge that it would be, that would be very useful if it was directed in the direction of research and development are in managerial position in the public sector. In other words, they are not applying, they are not using their, we are not using their true potential.
Or we're not actually encouraging a system where we need more of these researchers.
Yeah, they are there. I mean, you know, you have someone with, you know, you have a, you have someone with 3-4 masters.
Mm. That's a lot of money that was spent.
Yeah.
3-4 masters.
3-4 masters.
Please don't cite anyone.
Okay, fine.
Now, I know, I could see that you wanted to cite him. Please don't cite anyone.
Yeah, but the thing is, we more often have them in managerial positions.
Yeah. Or they
but
are...
these are the guys that are supposed to be at tertiary during the day and you know, sort of like balancing the ball of you know of you know of passing that knowledge through you know through tertiary education through through teaching and stuff, and also in those institutions now they're supposed to be spearheading research and development initiatives all across the board, agriculture, fishing, mining, you name it.
Mm. But where are we? On Svieti.
No, we'll just wait for someone to come and pour money in an investment, and then we'll start telling him how we fought for the country and how we deserve, on account that we have a Namibian ID, how we deserve 60% of what he has already poured billions of dollars into.
Yeah. Which also leads us to the other thing that Anicia Peters...
You know what? The whole thing of weed being illegal is a brilliant idea. Because, I mean, we're already high without it.
You say it'll just inflame a situation even
further.
It'll just
make worse.
It'll just make it worse.
Yeah.
So, I finally found the thing I was looking for.
Yeah.
I wanted to highlight the subsidiary body's 64th session, which is this meeting, basically. Some of the particular in-session documents that they had. I had to go and literally go through this whole website 50,000 times. Finally found it. Now, the matters relating to global goal adaptation, that's one single document right there, is the one that's obviously been the core concern for all of us. Download the document, finally.
Yeah.
Specifically being that what was on the agenda at this global climate meeting in Bonn, Germany, was that they had to stick to the Paris Agreement, meaning the subsidiary body for scientific and technological advice and the SBI, which is the other subsidiary body, I forgot what the I is, they highlight that they've got to stick to the agenda item on terms of matters relating to the global climate goal on adaptation as a standing agenda item, and that it will continue to be included in the agendas for subsequent sessions of the subsidiary bodies, and also back later in November 2026, and also subsequent sessions of the Conference of Parties at the of the Paris Agreement, unless it's otherwise obviously stipulated. The particular notion here, meaning, which should tell any person basically out there, what's the progress? Well, if people at the climate engagement level or of a national, okay, governmental level have to still tell each other, we've got to stick to the Paris Climate Agreement to meet deliverable goals. Fundamentally, the things that you and I cited now just before this particular point, fundamentally, that should show anyone that there are still major differences in understanding the goals between each country.
Sober and greedy. Remember that?
Basically, you know, sober and greedy. It's I didn't actually see. Oh, no. Did we talk about the SDG report for 2026 earlier this year?
I don't think so.
I think we did.
Really?
But we didn't cite it. We'll have to look up. Ons moet loop check. Ons moet check. Ons moet check.
Ons sal
check. Ons sal kyk. Ons sal uitkyk vir hom. Look at me now. Trying to empower the Afrikaans here now. We'll have Uncle Bonner calling in a few seconds right now. Uncle Bonner, not yet, Uncle Bonner. Not yet. Not yet. Not yet. But yeah.
Ons sal fat kyk.
Funny. Why did you say fat cook?
Oh.
That's what you said. Fat kyk. Ek gesê ons sal uitkyk. Eight, meaning out, cake, look, outlook, eight cake.
Oh, wait.
Eight cake. Ons sal eight cake vir dit. We will look out for it.
Okay, we'll put a pause on that Afrikaans because the you know.
Nie fat cake.
Because my follow up sentence will just make things worse.
Oh no. Oh, no. And I know that one would have been in English, that follow-up sentence.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
More of a cocktail between English and Afrikaans.
And but you must emulate a Prime Minister Ngurare and his level of Afrikaans.
Oh, no. A lot of people have recommended the University of Pilo, but hey. the school fees have
what
gone up.
The hell? Where are we? Yeah, okay. Let's come back. Let's stick to adult stuff. Yeah. Besides the other adult stuff.
Yeah.
Now there's obviously a whole bunch of particular, you know, technical jargon, but there's also something from the Baku adaptation. Because the first adaptation points basically says, okay, let's start from a central point. But the Baku, which is Azerbaijan of 2 years ago. Cites specifically that they've got to look at a roadmap or stick to a roadmap. This is paragraph 16. They've got to agree on concept notes for future workshops under a roadmap. Now, here's an interesting thing. Just before we stepped into the studio. Now, there's a related UN website, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. The IPCC, yes, the IPCCC. Those guys, Helmut, have listed under their reports tab on the website, reports in 2027. And I've been confused since last week because I've been hanging on that website trying to understand things. You know, why would you list a report in the future? Literally, Helmut, they listed. Meaning, this report is envisaged to come out in these various reports, which is the next assessment report their next AR report. The last one that was done in 2022 was listed on the website on 2023. Mm-hmm. It's the one where I also found specifically that Namibia and Botswana technically have to are technically 2 degrees hotter than the rest of the world. Mm. Namibia and Botswana together. So the global climate average, the temperature average that they keep talking about, the 1.5 degrees Celsius to the 2 degrees Celsius maximum, is cascaded around the world. But you already have two countries in Southern Africa that are already 2 degrees hotter than anyone else.
That means if things go full popcorn, we'll be the first to go.
We'll be the ones walking around without our shirts going like, how's it, but? How's it? You know, with the sunscreen on and everything. We'll be coming to work in shorties and blackies.
Eish.
Imagine that, Albert.
No, for the sake of my sanity, no.
Not the shorties and blackies. I'm just talking about the cooking, the popcorn situation.
Oh, okay.
Not that we will be going like popcorn, guys. It's a bit extreme.
No, like we won't. Yeah, we won't be going for popcorn.
We might be the frog in the water.
You know, the excellent example of how, you know, over how this this discussion is going. Look, this is an international organization.
Yeah.
So you are talking about, under the United Nations, we are talking about, over 100 countries
yeah.
that have to come up with a unanimous consensus on how to solve a problem. In this case, a climate change problem. There are, of course, bound to be, you know, disagreements in how things should be done. And we see this on a national level, where you have, every 5 years, you have a bunch of political parties taking each other to court because they can't agree on, how the election should have been conducted, or how the polls, or how many polls, or how many, we debate on everything, including the voting date and all that.
Mm.
So now, when you look at it from our most democratic practice, in this case, consultations, it's even one of those things where you have different conflicting ideas, but at the end of the day. As long as we are making progress ahead, because if you take all that discourse, which is the center of much of the disagreements we complain about,
yeah.
if you take that out, democracy is also out through the window. So as much as we have a lot of conflicting ideas on how to navigate the climate challenges, especially in relation to climate mitigation strategies. The disagreements are part of it. So, you can't get rid of that. As long as you have two people having a discussion on a specific topic, they're bound to have you're bound to have a different opinion. Now, when you look at that from a global level, there are even going to be more variety of different opinions on how to solve the problem.
Yeah.
So difference in how to navigate the climate change mitigation strategies and implementation and all that, coming from the global south saying that this is not our solution, that's expected in a large group discourse. But so what then that means is if I was the Global North representative, I would just pump the brakes on everything Global North in terms of discussing it in terms of implementation in the global south, would you say, okay, now, all right, this is what is coming from the global north, and from the look of things, we have a unanimous consensus on how to implement, whether it's EVs or mass solar energy rollout, or wind energy, or renewable energy cooking sources of energy, which would be a brilliant idea. But now, as a global south, if this doesn't sit well with you, what are your proposals? What are you proposing? Because I would really like to hear what we bring up in terms of, and I'm sure there are a lot of academics out there that have said a lot of things in that line, in a way of proposing how these things should be done from a developing country perspective.
The nice thing is, Amut, that we actually do have access as Namibia. Mm-hmm. As Namibia, we have access to many countries and their knowledge scenarios. It's a question of whether or not we are technically trying to achieve the goals. Mm-hmm. I use the template of the the article we had in our e-paper, the one about the VTCs that can only supply 1,000 graduates,
yeah.
whereas the green industries will have a demand for 29,000 graduates, which obviously shows you that it's a massive shortfall.
Yeah.
Because firstly, it seems like we are just producing. A second scenario is ultimately also looking at the dimension in terms of where Namibia's economy wants to go.
Yeah.
Now, I know it's just day one. It's a Monday that I touched base with this work, with this workshop. And obviously the conversations we've had here on Eagle FM have, you know, we've actually advanced the scenario. You know, we've literally advanced the discussions to go into slightly technical, more technically understanding in terms of looking at understanding, thinking, perspectives, what reinforces these perspectives. Is it based on any evidence? What is the evidence out there? Things like that. We also have to acknowledge that there's a lot of Namibians that probably don't think or know about the climate change scenario. They hear about a disaster or they experience a disaster and they need immediate relief. For example, what happened in Spain like last year, the Valencia flooding, the city of Valencia.
Yeah.
Where
the warning system
was coming on, when the SMS was only coming on through when the people were standing in the water or the water was around their kneecaps.
Yeah. that's not a warning system.
I mean, the reporting that I saw then, from, what was it? France 24, and the other one was Deutsche Welle, because I watched most of those things on YouTube. The reporting I saw from those two news sites, Helmut, was a scenario of, they are going to go ask you. You are now the person on the ground, the victim of this flash flooding. They go ask you, Helmut, how do you feel? How do you ask someone a question where you can clearly see the person is in distress? How do you feel? They ask questions like that. And you sit there thinking to yourself, what must I do with this information? You immediately feel for someone when you hear or you read the meta, you know, the metadata, which is literally the description of the video, and the video, the title of the video, that's the metadata on YouTube.
Yeah.
You can immediately read there and see and identify if the thing is properly aligned with what is in the video, that these are concerned people who were impacted because of a flash flood. Né? Now, the reporter shows up and asks the victim, how do you feel? What were you doing? Where were you when the flooding happened? Did you get any early warning? The person already suffered the disaster. The person already decided. Now it's about collecting. And it's one of these things that this profession of ours now, Helmut, has this narcissism to it. I mean, you go ask the victim, how do you feel after being, you know, after being mugged? Or you ask the victim, how do you feel that the asset forfeiture department now relieved you of your personal possessions, which in many cases you probably won't see those personal possessions anymore. You probably know that going to make a case or register a case with the police will also be futile because you'll just go and buy your assets once again. Mm-hmm. So what will be the purpose of the police pursuing this particular avenue? And then, or in the result, for example, like a flash flood that obviously destroys your personal belongings, you obviously know that the state will reimburse you for you suffering this because the state's early warning system didn't work.
Yeah, it didn't work.
And then you sit there thinking like, what questions is this journalist asking about how do you feel after now being half washed away? And not being fully washed away, but partially washed away. How do you feel?
Do you see, you know, there's a meme. Of course, there's always a meme when it comes to Helmut. There's a meme I found on social media of a car accident.
Yeah.
Where the front, you know, the windscreen of the car was basically blown clean off, and the driver, the driver, I guess, wasn't wearing a seatbelt. He was laying from the waist up.
Through the
window. Yeah, on the bonnet.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, the rest of him was still in the car. Now,
and then how much?
Now, it was, and then there was a picture of a journalist, let's just put it like that, asking the victim now. Is this a car accident? The man's response was like, no, I'm just laying down. Like, the windscreen is blown clean off. Like, it should be that obvious.
Yes.
And you still want to know, what are your thoughts?
On how did you end up here?
How do you end up here?
Well, I don't know, Sherlock.
It wasn't planned.
Care to investigate with me?
The Sherlock was unnecessary.
Care to investigate with me, Sherlock?
But look, I think the point that the global South countries are making here,
yeah,
in terms of not addressing the root cause,
yeah,
which is basically letting the status quo continue in the direction that we should be deviating from.
Yeah,
if you look at it, the reason why we are having this discussion is because of this exact same approach to problems.
Yeah.
In the early days of Industrial Revolution, if there were enough regulations on how to apply the technology, this would have avoided a lot of this.
How much?
But everyone was just focused on let's make as much money as possible.
It's not just that particular narrative that also feeds in, or perspective, not just narrative, perspective.
Yeah.
It's also at that stage, Hammond, when you look at primarily the impact of colonialism, that's why I love that press release from that coalition, that Global Forest Coalition guys,
yeah,
who basically said, but your solutions are not our ideas. Your solutions are trying to meet your guilty conscience in the global north,
uh-huh,
for what you caused for 100 or close to 200 years.
Yeah.
When you look at primarily, and this is why I love the neutral economists. The neutral economists will always explain to you the historical implications. They won't go into a mathematical equation for the fun of it with you.
Yeah.
They'll just go and tell you, well, it's because that government had that policy. That government leader came from that particular generation in that country's historical context, and it was influenced because of that particular period before that government,
yeah,
came into being, that particular historical context that country had.
Yeah.
Which is a clear indication to you that many of the fields of study that we've got today, mm-hmm, is about us, society. This is not about looking at, okay, mathematics is not abstract, but in the minds of everyone.
In a way that is comprehensible to the majority, basically. Because if you talk math terms and equations, I'll be looking at you like, you're going to have to break that down because I have no clue what you're saying.
But here's the thing, man. The guys, for example, like much of, just citing a little bit, but I only had like the first year economics at Polytechnic at NASP before it became NASP. When you look at economics, it relies a lot specifically on probability, meaning statistics.
Yeah.
So probability will help you if you sit with an idea of what is the probability that everyone in this room, which is just the two of us, mm-hmm, which is 1/2,
yeah,
the probability is that, let's for example say, we participate in this conversation that we are airing today here on Eagle FM, mm, at this particular junction on the 20th of July. And
oh, teacher's pay day. Oh, sorry.
Go where on. Now, Ned? Oh, you remembered. Yeah. You forgot to wish them, Elmo.
Totally forgot. Yeah. Thanks, man.
So from that particular direction, you can immediately then identify, okay, so the probability of participation of Dwight and Helmut in today's conversation,
mm,
is 1/2. 0/5. Half the total contribution discussion.
Yeah.
The more people we have in studio, the smaller that probability becomes.
Yeah.
Ne? So you just count, if there are 2 people, it's 1/2. If there are 4 of us, it's 1/4. Obviously, now finding the exact statistical contribution for the time period of the show, 3 hours. Mm-hmm. What is the time frame that each person contributed? That is now a different statistical, analysis that you've got to imply,
yeah,
or that you've got to base your analysis on. So you know that the theory is, or that the theoretical hypothesis is, 1/2. But when you look at the actual time frame, you go and count, evaluate, look at the total contribution that Dwight and Helmut each contributed to today's program of the home run. Then you assess, okay, based on the 1/2 probability, what is the actual spread of said particular participation over the 3 hour period? Now, that is where the economics of the day, which I saw obviously also at Polytechnic or NAS, where they try to go this math, full math direction.
Math is very cool if you are giving a lecture to students, but if it's just a presentation at a stakeholder engagement, for example,
yeah,
you're gonna miss everyone.
Yes, you are. And the second thing is also, Helmut, just before you get on with the missing everyone,
yeah,
there was a lecturer we had there at Polytechnic. He started out as the part-timer's lecturer. He used to say, from school, ne? He would work out the answer and he'd say, from school, ne? And we're like, brah, where are you? Where? Why are you saying from school? But then we realized there's a major disconnect,
yeah,
because what was taught on school, and some of us had the options to skip past mathematics and select subjects that didn't have math in it because we wanted to run away from division specifically.
Yeah.
To what you discovered on a tertiary level,
yeah,
is primarily that tertiary level secondary prepares you for tertiary.
Yeah.
But yeah, you were saying, looking nice on a board and in presentation levels.
Yeah. No, the thing is, look at it. You know how you have a lot of geopolitical tension going on, especially in Western countries, where you look at the politicians and they are making the rookiest of the rookiest mistakes. And you have experts in the very same countries,
yeah,
pointing out that, you know what, this and this and this, I have been saying this for a very long time. The direction that the Western, Western economies have taken, for example. Whether it's Europe or North America.
Yeah.
Well, what you see is that in 2000, man, and that's something that I can't, to this day, I can't wrap my mind around. In 2000, Jim O'Neill tells Western countries, basically, that the direction in terms of economic trends, the direction the economy is taking is, it's going to the global south. It's going to, to countries. Now, if you want your economy to thrive in the next coming decades, you may want to make friends out of Brazil, Russia, China, South Africa, India,
and Iran.
And Iran. The politicians in the country of this genius man who was giving them economic prophecy.
Who said it?
Jim O'Neill. Yeah.
Okay.
This man was basically looking at the
at the future,
at the future economically,
yeah,
and he got it spot on. Did the politicians listen? They decided to make enemies out of the very same people they were told to make friends out of.
Yeah.
And now, China is the bad guy. Russia is the bad guy. Iran, there's a white genocide in South Africa. Let's bomb Iran.
Yeah.
They should have avoided all this nonsense.
Let's blockade Cuba.
Let's blockade all this nonsense. Now, you see, this, the disconnect between politicians and academics.
Mm.
That disconnect, it turns out it goes way far back. Much of the problems that we have gone through that a lot of countries has gone through would have been avoided if just someone in office listened to the, to an expert.
Yeah.
Now, if you go back to the 1850s, all the way through to the, go to the 1820s, go as far back as the 1820s.
As the Napoleonic Wars, yes.
1820s, man, scientists were telling them, there's something fishy about the global atmosphere, about the Earth's atmosphere.
Mm.
It looks like it's a little warming. Do you have any idea how long it took scientists to get politicians to listen?
But you do remember that the politicians that in the 1820s, yeah, were a bunch of hereditary guys.
Genetic, the lack of genetic diversification is one of the things
they were just inheriting.
Yeah.
And they were just getting roles.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you have a bunch of leaders, and this is now this is one of those.
Africa, don't worry, you guys didn't.
At that stage, we were literally still fighting.
People were sharpening the knives for us. Don't worry,
we're still fighting for dear life. But look,
okay,
I didn't make us out. Look, that is. Look, man.
There's a reality in that statement. Don't worry.
That is just climate change. Now, fast forward to the 1920s and 1950s.
Yeah.
Scientists come together again and start telling nations' leaders to regulate the tobacco industry because it was causing lung cancer.
And it would take decades. What did the tobacco industry do?
They
closed ranks.
Uh-huh.
They formed an industry body.
Yep.
To represent them, and they pumped money in it. Do you know, Helmut? Yeah, let me tell you another lovely story. Uh-huh. So, you know that Englishman that I watched, the guy, Gary Stevenson.
Who I told you was
being belittled by the other British politician Rory Stewart. Where Rory Stewart was busy sort of like questioning Gary Stevenson's educational background.
Yeah.
Because Gary comes out of a poor side of London. You know, he comes from a working class family.
Yeah.
And then Rory Stewart is part of the privileged political hierarchy of the British society. Meaning he technically inherits a lot of stuff.
What's his name?
And connections. Rory Stewart?
Rory McTrustfund from now.
Yeah, where, do you remember, he was the guy that I explained to you, was he doesn't have a degree in political science.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a degree, but he got a job as a lecturer at Harvard. You remember that story? Do you remember that story?
Holy cow.
I mentioned it here on air back in May. So Rory, from that discussion, Gary, in the first part of this year, meaning the first 3 months of this year, Gary was on tour in Australia.
Yeah.
And he meets up with this channel just started popping up on my feed. You know, he meets up with a guy who is a teacher. He's a qualified teacher in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And this teacher has his own YouTube channel because this teacher also became aware. That's why the reason why I say I don't conform with the American label of woke.
Mm-hmm.
Because I became aware specifically of Namibia's colonial history. I knew Namibia was colonized,
mm-hmm.
but by the time that I transitioned from my basically very veiled sales job into media and information,
mm-hmm.
you start reading a lot and you become very aware of realities around you. And then from that position, you then realize, okay, what direction does Namibia want to take? Now that I know all this information, now that I'm close to much of this information discourse, where the information is generated, where is Namibia heading? Now, the same thing happened to this guy, this teacher. Because he couldn't understand why is his... Because they have most gas, central heating.
Mm-hmm.
Gas for central heating in Australia. He couldn't understand why his gas bill was rising. Why his petrol is rising. But Australia produces petrol and gas.
Mm-hmm.
So why is he paying more for something that's produced locally?
Locally, yeah.
Then... He obviously started his own thing, started reading up, started participating in public dialogue, discussions, pub, and so on and so forth. So he started his own YouTube channel known as Punter's Politics. A punter in Australian and British lingo is someone that delivers commentary, like what you and I are
like
doing.
Commentator.
Yeah, and a commentator of scenarios.
Yeah.
So he realized that in Australia also has a very healthy lobby economy. So he decided, you know, let me do the same thing that the interest groups are doing,
yeah.
who hire lobbyists in, you know, close to their government or close to their politicians.
Yeah.
Then he decided, let me fundraise to hire a lobbyist. He was successful. He raised his money because, you know, Australians, they look like that mostly tongue-in-cheek society. If someone comes up with a harebrained idea, everybody goes like, hey, yeah, we'll put money to it. We'll put money to it. And then everybody, and he collected the money.
Yeah.
And he showed receipts. I hired this lobbyist.
Yeah.
And that the lobbyist was a woman.
Yeah.
She literally, because lobbyists have access to politicians, basically.
Yeah.
And they literally got an opportunity to present their case through that lobbyist. He just had a harebrained idea.
So, in other words, you have to play the game. You know, you have to play the game.
Play their game. Rules. Play their game.
Yeah.
Play the interest group.
So
game.
Basically, use their game against them.
Basically.
Works like a charm.
Works like a charm.
And that, I mean, yeah, using a lobbyist. I mean, that's a brilliant idea.
Paying even, crowdfunding and paying even.
Talk about saving democracy.
I just said now he explained this when he had Gary Stevenson on. He explained to Gary, this is what we went and did. Because he told Gary, we are in the process of crowdfunding to get a lobbyist to get their message across. Now, 2 years back, remember when I started this discussion on that Alaska fund? The fund that just collects money and then every year pays out at a certain time of the year money to people in Alaska.
Citizens.
As long as you prove that you haven't been convicted of a crime.
Yeah.
And that you've at least been living there for 6 months. That's the only requirements for the fund. Nothing else. Don't commit a crime. And you should have been a resident for 6 months. Mm-hmm. He went and analyzed and asked, does Australia have a sovereign wealth fund for Australians? No, they don't. And then he asked, so
they have a bunch of natural resources, but it's zero.
The only thing they are collecting is taxes. Something similar to what Namibia is experiencing. Meaning, they're only collecting the basic taxes that the companies comply with, which is technically not their fault, which is obviously the governmental perspective. Mm. I mean, Helmut, if you look at Namibia's mineral, the Minerals Act, and the affiliated acts below the Minerals Act, Namibia's legislation is 100 years old, bruh. It's literally the National Arts Fund and National Arts Council discussion all over again. I found out the other time, I read somewhere, I have to look it up once again. We need to develop a synthetic fuels act or legislation because of green hydrogen. Because the power to X, which basically speaks to synthetic fuels being produced, like aircraft fuel. Fuel for aircraft and other particular things, because the power to X basically replaces the petrochemicals from the oil and gas.
So you're talking about a spectrum of different,
exactly.
Fuels that are coming from one crude source.
Exactly. Where is that conversation? The green hydrogen will start flowing and is already being produced in spots a lot quicker before we get to the oil and gas discussion. Where is that piece of legislation, Helmut? That adds on to the list that we counted. Remember with the State of the Nation address, where you and I counted like 13 to 12 pieces of bills
that are just
that need to be finalized, that was not finalized even in last year. There are so many outstanding pieces of legislation just hanging loosely there somewhere. And because we chopped and changed ministries, legislation that was under those ministries that don't exist anymore, we now have to go and rediscover where are those documents as well. So conversations like that, unfortunately, which feeds into this June climate meetings discussion, we as Namibians, we're not satisfying our own particular aspect of discourse. Meaning, what's the status of implementation of things? Where are we? But in the meantime, Namibia has to be worried with a digital ID. Do you know where it comes from, Namun?
Where?
It comes from that act that you and I cited that replaced the Electronic Devices Act of 1985. It comes from the Electronic Transactions Act that the Bank of Namibia is in charge of. For Crayon to mention last week, we're going to champion key infrastructure in development and the rollout of digital IDs. I was thinking to myself, which Namibia needs a digital ID vandaag? Why do you need a digital ID?
This is a Helmut that lives in Tura. But he has friends that lives in Ludwigsdorf.
Yeah.
So now he wants to adopt the lifestyle that he's seeing in Ludwigsdorf in his house in Tura. And that's what you're looking at here. Now, look, digital IDs and all these things, if you ask me, all these things for convenience in terms of interoperability and from an administrative standpoint, they're a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
But if you ask me development-wise, this is not the priority.
This is not a priority.
It's not.
But we still have to look at it. I mean, it's a discussion that happened on Friday. We will still look at it.
Yeah.
I cited it primarily because the bigger danger between not having a digital ID as a Namibian and us being the frog in the boiling water on the stove is a bigger reality than not having a digital ID.
We have a lot of priorities.
No, we've got a bunch of misaligned priorities.
Misaligned.
Remember when I sent you that one piece of that one audio back in last year for one of the procurement trackers where the IPPR cited specifically Namibia is developing legislation meant for a developed country, but we are still a developing country, which is your reference to I am living in Tura, but I've got homies living in Ludwigsdorf.
Yeah. And you know, it's a good thing you brought up that example of us adopting a first world, let's go with global north development, global north legislations for a country that is still, in the global south. You know what? When we were upgraded from,
last year, from upper. We were downgraded.
When we moved from lower middle to upper middle.
That was 2015.
We were complaining, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? Now we don't have access to all these
loans.
Financial avenues.
Yeah.
Hang on a second. So, we don't want to develop, we don't want to be told we are developing practically, but we are busy setting up legislations that reflects exactly what we don't want to.
No, we don't want that, Almut.
Again, I'm Beckett Weed here. Illegal, brilliant idea.
I'll share something else also with you. Yeah. So earlier today in that workshop, and I am so, what do you call it? I'm so fresh from the perspectives given there.
Yeah.
Many of the people that joined me in that workshop, and that's one of the reasons why I said, I don't understand why technically I was there. It seems like my name was just bounced in there.
Yeah.
So, because technically I felt like a veteran. I felt like the library sitting there at a bookshelf convention, you know?
Yeah.
So, one of the first things was that some people, like some of the participants, had to try and understand the impact of climate change.
Yeah.
But here on Eagle FM, we've already proven the point that you can live either in urban or in rural. Urban communities don't see the impact of climate change so quickly. They would know that a day is just hot for the sake of it being super hot, but the person in the rural community is the first person experiencing the negative impacts of climate change.
Yeah.
So many of us media practitioners are urbanites. We live in urban settlements. We don't live out in the bush every day. We don't cycle in from the bush to come and do the work here. Yeah, you could probably go and live in the bush, but then it'll be something with all the particular conveniences, like it'll have a shower, it'll have electricity, it'll have a solar panel for that matter. But that's not the kind of rural community that I'm even talking about. I'm talking about people that don't even have access. On the living standards measure, that thing that I spoke about, the LSM, you would find people that are probably living within the first 10 of the living standards measures, meaning they probably have a structure they call a house. They probably have access to water, which might be a borehole water, but they don't have access to a geyser. They don't have access to electricity. It might be a solar panel for certain particular functions. They probably don't have, they're probably not part of a community that is electrified in terms of households, and they probably don't pay tax because the income that they make is not so substantial to be regularly paying tax.
Tax category.
Exactly. So that is the first particular indications that you first have to work from. Yet, those are the communities that are first getting impact because in the rural areas, they see the climate change. You come to the urban centers, you don't see the climate change. Do you know what's Windhoek's indicator of climate change, Hamid? Of a drought. Do you know what's
in an air-conditioned room?
No, not just that. Do you know what's Windhoek's biggest indicator?
Oh, yeah.
Is when a kudu comes walking down one of the riverbeds into the city And the Vindhukas are going crazy. There's a kudu! There's a kudu! There's possibly an outbreak of rabies! Please, City of Vindhukam, do some. And then City of Vindhukam goes and hires a very expensive consultant. Mm. He's got a rifle this big, Hammond. Let me show the audience. The rifle is massive. I saw it last year specifically. Kudu had ventured early in the morning down our street, and the guy had to be there by like 8 or 9 a.m. And if you think a silencer is soft for a high powered rifle, ne? As a leak story, Helmut. As a leak story. Do you know that you hear that, and that's a hunting rifle, ne?
Yeah.
Do you know that you hear that thing, specifically if it's like a piece of terrain or in a territory that has a lot of potential for echoes, for echo, for
yeah, which for, is that's basically the city.
Yeah, for the city to echo, for the sound to echo.
Yeah,
as a leak story. The only thing you don't hear is the qua. You just hear it's actually not a silencer, it's a suppressor. Wrong terminology also, guys. For us gamers, it's a suppressor. It does this, but it still echoes. This is the sound, but it still echoes. However, if you now have to ask any sort of like urban resident, what do you think is an indicator of climate change for you in a city like Vindhukam? The most potential thing is probably they will say the heat. They won't even talk about the potential water usage restrictions that City of Vindhukam would apply. They'll probably talk about the heat. Oh no, it's warm. It's hot today. Oh no, I'm baking today. Oh, look at me, I'm sweating, eh? Look at me. Let me get my handkerchief. You know, it's just overly hot today. You know, it's just hot. But before we continue, guys, we're actually going to take the promised ad break and come back right after that. Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tete opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuala. Onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile konderewa vera etatu natu bali o etatu batatu omafilane Eagle FM.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the Eye.
And coming back, dear listeners, there from the quick break. Well, we technically just had to stretch our legs a little bit because, yes, with the amount of content that we read, that we consume, and obviously some of the particular interesting points that we also contribute and add onto our discussions, as you can see, the conversation does stay stimulating and engaging. But before we continue, we're going to be taking an ad break here on your number one talk radio station. We'll be back right after that with a regular show. Vavitcha University, for the 2027 applications that are now open for the Faculty of Health Sciences for the following programs. Certificate for enrolled nurse, midwife, or accoucheur, level 6. Certificate in pharmacy, level 5. Diploma in environmental health sciences, level 6. Bachelor of social work honors, bachelor of nursing and midwifery science honors. Postgraduate diploma in community health nursing, level 8. Postgraduate diploma in occupational health and safety, level 8. Postgraduate diploma in mental health nursing, level 8. Master of public health and the master of occupational health and safety. For more information, please call 081-403-6406. Vavitcha University, where everyone is an achiever. Let's get the first caller's contribution coming through. Eagle FM, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Uncle Bona, how are you doing?
Good
afternoon.
Which language? Check there. I don't drink Oshkundu anymore. Oshkende. Oshkende.
Angabona, what
Oshkende.
Is
it?
The people from Hermit side. But I drink Oshkende. I don't know. How do you call it in Oshwamba or Kwangali?
Angabona, Angabona, where are we getting off with the Oshkundu Oshkenda reference?
Unless you look at it from the fact that, we're about to have a lot of sun for making Oshikundu. I don't see where that actually comes into the discussion.
Okay, Angobona, yes.
Good story.
Yeah. We got to get it out.
Some of this demodernization,
yeah.
The way the comparative, the comparison with the our traditional, just the way we speak of our language, the pronunciation or the accent.
Yeah.
So this one is from America. Is it America or British English or what?
Who, Angabona?
When we speak that language now, their pronunciation.
Which language?
No, I was just laughing when you were actually, I don't know whether you were emulating somebody.
Oh no, that was me, Angbon. I was just mocking. I was mocking a situation, it's hot, look at me, it's hot. No, yeah. Angbon, we predominantly speak British English. The Americans didn't invent English.
Too hot. Oh, there's no aircon. They have this handkerchief, and then it's hot,
Look at Angbon, why are you playing into the same act? Okay. I know.
Okay, so you are talking about Helmut, what is actually wrong with us adopting our registration, which might not be much similar to those other registration that they said they are not, they seem to be binding. But in a way, you discover that they are just binding to some other people and not to, I don't know. So even when Helmut talks and you guys talks about some of these things, uh-huh. I'm getting confused. I don't know where I am. I don't know where, So it's just in confusion. Saranda is just doing his own thing. This other one is doing his own thing. I'm hearing now that one of the leaders there, they say they want Trump to be, they are exploring some ways of arresting Trump.
Yeah.
I mean, not Trump, the Israeli Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now, one wonder, what legislation are they using? Yeah, what laws are they using?
They are using the Benjamin Franklin law.
Oh, Benjamin Franklin law.
Yeah.
Which is the $100 law.
Yeah, just have money.
Yeah, just have money. The $100 law is just have money.
Oh my God. Yeah.
But to answer your other question, Angabona, or your first part of your question, meaning the applicability of these international agreements as we go along. If we look at what we just cited now specifically, because in the start of the discussion we cited
some of the press releases and contributions by interest groups that were participating at this global climate meetings in Germany in June. It has been because the thing is, Angabona, nothing gets agreed upon right there. The agreement has to come at the end of the year. So these guys are preparing for end of the year. Now the downside is you are seeing discussions, engagements happening as if it's the decision maker sitting there in front of, you know, there at the table, they, you know, concerned with some of the major decisions that might impact their country or their nation. But it's not the major decision maker because it's a representative by that decision maker.
Oh, yeah.
Or it might be a gatekeeper that's a representative by the decision maker of that country sitting in that climate meeting there in Bonn in Germany back in June. So the question which you asked basically, Angabona, was applicability. Why does it seem like some things are applied by some countries and by not by others? Well, if you take a small island, a least developed nation, let's say like Malawi or like Tonga in the Oceania group, Tonga's government, Angabona, is probably like 10 people.
Yeah.
That's their cabinet, probably 10 people. So one person probably, or each person in that cabinet probably has like multiple roles. In the society of that country. And when you come to Namibia, our cabinet is a very big one that meets the 3 million Namibian population strong needs, meaning they are positioned in that scenario, which is deemed as adequate by the planners of the government to respond adequately to Namibian needs. However, with the discussion that we are seeing, what representative do you think potentially is sent by, let's say, the United States that has 300 million people? What kind of a person is sent? It's definitely not a minister.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a representative do you think potentially is sent by a country like Nigeria? It might be a minister. It might not be a minister.
You know, France who was saying that when our leaders go to UK, China, and they are greeted by maybe a governor of a certain town. You know that.
You're talking about greeting. On Queen Elizabeth's funeral, they were shoved on a bus.
Yes, but why can't you just be contented with that?
A bus is an environmentally friendly option.
So, why can't you just be contented? You just be satisfied with that.
Yeah.
Why do you have to worry? And say, no, people are not respecting you and all these other things.
Yeah.
Yeah? Well, not good.
Angabona, just to help you with that, the content part. It obviously, it obviously probably translates to the event or the occasion. Because I know that there's a lot of people when they reach certain offices in, in society or positions or stations in society, they want, they want a projection of the conveniences to reflect their status or their position. I mean, there's very few leaders in the world that would do like the former president of Uruguay, Mujica. Am I even saying the man's name correctly?
Isn't that man late now?
Yeah, the man, he's deceased. Isn't Mujica a tequila? What's the man's name?
Tequila, seriously.
But anyway, Angabona, so that guy in there, Angabona, he didn't want his government salary. He didn't want it because he lived on his wife's farm with his wife. You know, I would like to find a wife like that, but
Same here, man.
So he drove the same car for 50 years. He didn't have a presidential chauffeur, presidential cars. He didn't have a He showed up with his 50-year-old Levi jean and his 100-year-old leather jacket to office every day.
Yeah.
There's very few political leaders that will aim to do the same thing, Angabona. There's very few.
Yeah.
The majority wants, you know, iPhones with two SIM cards, which is understandable.
Yeah, majority ones want to be Air Force One around the world.
you know, Range Rovers.
Right, but the province, the Cap France says that the province of that is leading a governor of that particular area. Is reading about millions of people, the population more than Namibia.
Mm.
And they say, oh, it was very interesting. So anyway, guys, it's all the best.
100% Angabona, see you again.
So, so the guy's name was Jose Mujica.
Mujica.
Mujica is a J. The J is the yeah it's pronunciation. Yeah, not H. Not hello. Ye. Mujica. Look, it's Spanish. That's why I don't speak. When I realized the double L is a Y, Y is Y, and J also becomes a Y, I was like, okay, sharp,
we're
Owens.
Done here.
Sharp, Owens. Keep your language to yourself. At least you can have the confusion of Mandarin where a J and a ZH, a J and a ZH have the same pronunciation. What's the other pronunciation that sounds literally like ch, like ch?
Yeah.
Chinese, if you write, they use the alphabet like we know it, and they call it pinyin to write the pronunciation of the Mandarin word out for you,
mm-hmm.
to read it in your westernized background.
The alphabet, yeah.
But there's no ch, but there is a ch pronunciation. But the zh is a J pronunciation. And there's no J. And there is a J, but there's no J.
My name starts with an X in Russian because they don't have an H. No. And
Hamut, explain those other things of Russian that okay. How an A and an N are two different.
You know how you write the English word port?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except the English letter P in Russian alphabets, that's an R.
Mm.
So the Russian word for mouth is rot. So now when you write it.
I'm thinking in Afrikaans because rot means rat in Afrikaans.
No. So when you write the word rot,
yeah.
For me as an English speaker, it looks like the English word pot.
Because it's a P.
Yeah, because it's a P.
But the P in Russian is an R.
It's an R. So it's not pot, it's rot.
No, but that funny N they've got. They've got two N's. There's the reverse N and then the N that looks like a weird H N.
What they actually did is, they took the letter, the English letter N,
yeah.
Flip it upside down. That's an I. Yeah.
The English letter.
The English letter capital N.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Flip
for November.
N. Yeah.
Yeah.
Flip
you
it
will see
down.
on the Russian alphabet. It's like it's flipped upside down.
And yeah, that's the one that looks like a reverse N.
Yeah, that's the I.
That's the letter I.
That's the letter I.
Now, what is the letter I?
The letter I is would be okay. What would be
the I?
The letter I is basically that upside down N.
No.
Yeah,
like an I. What is the I? Because if we read Russian,
yeah,
we see N. Or reverse N and then we
which
go
is
like,
upside down.
And we go so, like, did these guys just write?
So what you see is a capital H
yeah.
on the alphabet. Now that is the N.
Hiya. Oh my goodness. Maybe I should have a pot, maybe I should take it, try and see if I can learn Russian as well and see what's going on there.
Yeah, and they are
Cyrillic. I'll just go talk Afrikaans with the Germans. I don't need to learn German.
Yeah, look, the alphabets are known as Cyrillic alphabets because yeah. they are attributed to, Greek. Something, Cyril. That's from Cyril. That's the guy that basically put all the alphabets together. That's why they're called Cyrillic alphabets.
But isn't the name Cyril Greek?
The alphabets, if you look at the Russian alphabets and the Greek alphabets are very much similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I see similarities. That's why also you've got Greek Orthodox, the yeah. religion spread from there, and you've got Russian Orthodox.
I'm not sure which specific dialect or language in the Zambezi region which has, a few similarities with Russian, especially how they pronounce the word B. You have names coming out of the Zambezi region if you read it on the paper, it looks like Mukubonda, but that's not how you read it. Mm. It's Mukuvonda. The B is a V.
Like Spanish.
So
Barcelona is Bathal. No. No, it's V in Spanish. It's V for
Vaseline. But
it's V for B.
But the thing is,
Vaseline. Baseline.
But the thing is, they have the V would be in names like Mukuvonda, the B is a V. So the capital B in Russian alphabets is also a V.
Mm. Yeah, it says here that Cyrillic is closely based on the Greek alphabet.
They just decided to add a few.
So technically, the Russians are technically Greek.
Just because
of the language, the alphabet.
Yeah, that's why they have a bunch of words that sound like they were borrowed from English, but they actually, most of them are coming from Greek. Because that's where English also got those words from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dimochus.
It's
like English now. When that French, I want to show you that video. When that French linguist back in last year, now there's a guy that was a YouTube
channel, who said it's badly pronounced French.
Badly pronounced French. and then he went like, if you go look at all the French language influences because of William the Conqueror when he took over, because he invaded the territory that his cousin was in charge of, Harald Hardrada.
His cousin. It has always been a family project.
Yeah, it's always a family project. So William brought a whole bunch of Frankish laws and customs with. So meaning he replaced the Saxon nobility with Norman nobility. So the Normans now bring in laws that the Saxon subordinates now have to understand, which is, okay, now you have to write your name with O-U, if you have names that have that. Words like glamour, favor, neighbor have O-U in it.
Yeah.
That's why, guys, don't write American English, which just drops the U to get to the O, because the Americans didn't invent the language. They didn't.
It's not,
the Americans live in denial that they were ever colonized.
That's the thing, right? They basically, the obvious sign is that they are also speaking with, just like us, language of their, a colonizer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's their thing. But yeah, Helmut, we were still on the indication. You were still making a point.
Now, why do I always have the point of view that most of these things are legislative problems? From my climate change warnings coming from scientists back in the 1820s to the link between cancer and tobacco, the link between cancer and tobacco smoking back in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And just all the way to Jim O'Neill and the direction that the global economy is taking back to, in the 2000s. In both, these three, 1820s, 1920s, 1950s, all the way to 1994, and you have then you come to 2000. All these three events, one thing they have in common is experts in the field.
Mm.
Experts in the field of science in the 1920s were telling leaders, who were basically a bunch of people that were just marrying each other's cousins and siblings to keep power in the family. They didn't listen to the scientists, and now we are having that. We're having conference after conference after conference.
Yeah.
And fast forward to the 1920s. 1920s, basically 1920s, the tobacco industry was very fragmented.
Yeah.
But the 1950s, scientists started coming up with evidence linking lung cancer to smoking, but politicians again didn't listen. It wasn't until 1994, that's when you see a bunch of tobacco guys basically being brought to court, where they had a lot of swear to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, or you'll be held in contempt of court. And then they took the stand and lied through their teeth. and they got away with it. Now, first of all, to the 2000s, you have again an economist, an expert. So you have weather experts in the 1820s telling nations leaders that the global atmosphere, the global temperature was rising.
Yeah.
You have medical experts in the 1950s telling nations leaders cigarette smoking was linked to lung cancer. You had an economic expert in the 2000s telling nations leaders the direction the global economy was taking. In all these instances, not a single time nations leaders sat there to say, you know what? We were just voted here because we said a bunch of, we quoted a bunch of Shakespeare quotes, and then a bunch of people put crosses with a pencil right next to our name in the ballot papers, which is why we got here. We are not experts at anything. But you know how the beautiful thing is how the how the structures are set up in terms of administrative structures are set up, at least in democratic societies. Even if you are not an expert economist, for example, you can be a minister of finance. But because you have, you'd make a terrible one, as you can imagine. But the thing is, you have financial experts.
I don't know whose salt you're rubbing in, Helmut.
You have financial experts to give you you have economic experts to give you the right course of action in economic decision making.
Yeah.
You have legal experts to give you the right course of action to take in terms of legal decision making.
Yeah.
Now, all these things these people are basically at your disposal.
Yes.
But it's either these people were not used in all these three instances, and there are also two examples that I covered a little extensively in my show yesterday, but I just brush through it.
Yeah.
We have had since 2015 2015 and 2021 we have had two ministers that exercised their power given to them by the acts. And they exercised that power terribly that they ended up in court. The court had to tell them, guys, yes, you had the power, but you wrongly exercised your power. And now,
don't worry, guys. It happened in past. Don't worry. It's our fodder for today. Don't worry.
Now,
it feeds our discussion.
Now, let's start with 2015 now, shall we?
Yeah.
Now, the Airport Companies Act. Namibia just wanted to extend to expand our international Jose Kutako International Airport, and a tender was put up of I think about 2015 December. That's when
it was the 8 billion.
8 billion.
It was the 8 billion.
That's in Namibian dollar.
Oh yes, right. Because it was in US dollars.
In US dollars. And interesting enough, in the case, in the case, it's recorded in a US dollar denomination. But this is a Namibian case, which is something that I didn't understand. But here's the. After the tender was made, was put up, obviously a lot of people, just decided to apply for the bid. And then one company in December won that tender.
Yeah, Chinese company.
A lot of people decided to go nuts in the media, making all kinds of allegations.
I know, I know the fallout that happened.
Now,
where President Geingob literally went like, Owens, what's going on here?
Now, the president is the one that started that matchstick for the minister, where he,
matchstick.
The minister could, the minister's tail caught fire in court. Now, here's the thing: people think politics is boring. Oh no, it's not. The president assured the Namibians, who were clearly confused at this point, that, you know what, I will tell the minister to invoke Section 9. Now, this Section 9 of Airports Company, that is the Section 9 he invoked. Just read the first part.
The whole Section 9?
Section 9, Subsection 1.
Okay. So Section 9, Subsection 1, this is the power of the minister to give direction to company.
Uh-huh.
The minister may, if he or she considers it necessary for
or expedient to the national security or for the discharge of an international obligation of the state after consultation with the company by notice in writing to the company, issue a direction to the company to A. Perform any function conferred or imposed on the company by or under this act or perform such functions subject to such limitations or conditions as the case may be.
Now stop at B.
Because it only stops at B.
Yeah, yeah.
Discontinue any relevant activity specified in advance.
Now, the directions that the president recommended, which the minister followed, was to ask the company to discontinue all the activities.
Yeah.
What does the last piece of Section 1 says? In writing.
Yeah, specified with specified with notes provided in writing. Yeah.
Now, just read the first paragraph. Now, that's the case. That's the judge telling your minister.
Was only the instruction to make a notice sent out to the president's media release and confirmation of those terms by the permanent secretary in correspondence to the NAC. There was no text of any notice in writing which the minister himself was to have issued to the NAC. This is yet further failure to comply with Section 9.
How specific do you want it to be? Provide it in writing.
Do you know what's the worst part, Herman? Do you know what's the worst part?
What's the worst part?
You can't even find the person that cost the ministry that embarrassing court case. Because primarily, the fault would go to the minister. The fault would not go to, at that stage, it mentions permanent secretary.
Yeah.
And under the first term of Kainu.
Yeah, because it was the, because it was the permanent secretary that basically, you know, because if you look at the beginning of the case, I think it was in the 15th of December.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's the one that basically notified, interesting enough, in writing, the company that they have won the bid. But when it came to, you know, to exercising their power in sort of like putting all activities in hold.
Wait. So the minister was thrown under the bus.
Well, the minister had to obviously show up and explain.
Thrown under the bus. Look, if there was some sort of a paper trail of a notice given there, the notice is given by someone who's not the minister, and the minister was the person who was supposed to give the notice, then that means the minister, it's a...
So, the minister was... Now, your minister had to go and explain all this.
He had to go to court. For something he did not do.
You know that lecture that the Office of Ombudsman provided to Namara?
Yeah.
That's the same thing that the court was doing to the minister.
Oh, guys. I mean, look.
Namibia.
It's not our intention. It's not our intention, but literally, this is ultimately what happens when, you know, when the home run comes about, you know, we stumble upon certain scenarios. Okay.
The instructions are very simple. Do it in writing.
Yeah.
And then fast. Yeah. And then fast forward to 2021.
Yeah.
Your minister of agriculture.
Yeah.
Who was given the power by Section 93 of the Digital Registries Act of 2015.
Yeah.
You know, to bring into force this new piece of legislation that will replace the Rehoboth 1976 and the Namibia 1937.
Yeah.
The instructions were very simple. Publish first and wait after 30 days and then put it in force.
And then announce that it's coming into force.
Bro was like, you know what? Is it published? Yes. Also tell them
let's
in force.
Let's do our job. Let's show how diligent we are. Yeah. Whoa. You were jumping the gun.
Commercial banks were like, Honorable Minister.
Yeah. Commissioner.
Can I have your supplier's number, please? Because, look, if...
What do you want?
Look, it's a very obvious mistake.
Do you need a doctor's letter or something?
Look. Yeah. One thing I like about our, about our laws is minus the public procurement act, to some degree.
Yeah.
Is that on paper? It's amazing piece of literature.
Oh no, it's straight to the point. Some
it's
cases.
The exercise in a way that it will. It's the reality.
It's the reality.
And look, Personally, I don't point or more like blame the ministers a lot.
Yeah.
I just point a lot of fingers to the Attorney General in this case of the in the case of the airports company. And I mean, international international airport tender expansion.
Were they part of the respondents?
Look, the president was involved.
Yeah.
Yeah. The president's legal advisor is the Attorney General,
which is the government's legal advisor.
Shouldn't have they should have seen this thing coming from a mile away.
Yes. But any contracts that
the fact that they didn't and ended up in court.
But who was the AG then, Hamoud? That's Musnaf before the current guy. What's his name? Mbandeka.
Yeah, I think that was before.
There was a person before.
The thing is, the ministries, they have their own legal advisors.
Yeah.
The president have their own.
They have a whole ministry of justice.
They have the whole ministry. All they had to do was make a call.
Yeah. Look.
Can I do this?
Can you look into this for us?
You know, I learned that.
But they wanted to. They wanted most to empower local content and
well,
and local and local procurement.
They ended up being schooled.
Yeah.
Look, man. They said now in the TV show in the TV show scandal.
Yeah.
There's one guy that acted as that was acting as the Attorney General.
Yeah.
This guy was on a constant call. He was friends with the he was friend with the president's campaign fixer and also Kamboroto. Long story. Now the thing is, everything the presidency did, they called him.
Yeah.
We are about to do this and this and this. What does the law say on this?
Yeah.
What should we go with it or not? So what they always wanted to do was, do we have enough legal backing
to pursue a certain avenue?
Yeah, to sort of like, if there is a possible backlash, how are we going to explain our way out of this?
Yeah.
Using the law that we are about to break, if we are going to break it.
Yeah.
If it's too much to, if it's too much of an action to take in terms of, in terms of legal backing,
yeah,
then, then we can do it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was on a constant call. And that's how I actually like, maybe I watched a lot of, a lot of these movies. Now, I'm picturing sort of like every, administrative activities being conducted by a ministry or an SOE. I always assume it's conducted like that. Like, before I do that, I would call the legal advice.
What happened?
I always assume it's conducted before a minister make mistake
a that phone would, call.
Yeah, just contact your legal department and tell them, we're about to make this and this and this and this decision.
You know why I was laughing?
Yeah, why?
It's far from that reality.
Well, now you know why.
It's far from that reality. It's literally far. It's probably also a scenario.
Is it one of those things of I'm a minister, I can do whatever I want or something?
No, not okay. Okay, maybe the speed hump discussion on B1.
Oh yeah, that
looks and sounds like I'm a minister, I can do what I want. Because the whole idea of a freeway is for the traffic
to flow
freely, not to stop and then ram each other in the backside. No. So if we have to look at this discussion extensively, much of the breakdown of understanding the function that civil servants and the various functionaries of the government, like the ministries, the offices, and the agencies, is I think that the people that work there, Hamoud, don't deserve to be there because they probably don't know their work or their job or their job descriptions or the purpose of their offices or the purpose of their. I'm saying this.
Okay, that's even more scary.
I'm saying this candidly and in a very humane manner because, unfortunately, you see it sometimes in discourse. You see it sometimes in some of the people who also work in government that you might know. I mean, the reason why I have relaxed on the ministries and why I'm bashing the local authorities is because I can see whose realm of responsibility it is.
The realm of responsibility is a chain of command. Highest office is the president. Lowest office is the clerk in the filing division of a local authority. And the local authority has to basically be the implementer. Not this discussion of policies be aligning. No. If you are a local authority and you see, you know what? Why does my town still have gravel roads? What is the impact of gravel roads on the public health of the town, of the inhabitants of the town? None of them have done that. Another dimension before we hit the ad break was, for example, this dispute of the uranium exploration in Omaheke.
Yeah.
When the company literally told us journalists, we're the only ones that have done this research.
Yeah.
There's your starting point. We'll come back after the ad break.
Do you need toiletries and household cleaners? You won't get it cheaper than a You Save up to the 7th of June. Get 250 mm jars of Vaseline for only $25 Namibian. Smell fresh with Playboy roll-on deodorant for just $18.99 Namibian. Get 2 kg of Serve hand washing powder for just $49.99 Namibian. Get 750 mL sunlight dishwashing liquid for $28.99 Namibian. And get 2 boxes of Cares Maxi sanitary pads for only $12.99 Namibian. You Save. Where else?
Coming back there, dear listeners, from the quick break that we had, just the point I was going to make before the ad break, which I made quickly to Helmut before the break, or during the break, is, for example, when you had to look at like a date, just something like a data set, information about research you conducted, that, what's that company's name? The Headsprings guys. They told us journalists at the media event in May that they conducted their own research for, you know, assessing what deposits of uranium are there.
And those researches aren't, they are not cheap.
They're not cheap.
So for one thing, you know, about the extractive industry.
Because it's their research and development. It's their information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you come and claim something, like I spoke to Justicia because she also wrote an article. I told Justicia, you know, you can't ask for the data set of that people. No, it wasn't with her. It was another person. I used the example because Justicia tried accessing that data set. And I told the person, you can't access that thing because it's their information.
Yeah.
You would have to buy it because they spent money to collect the information. Now, in Namibia, we don't really understand the impact of copyright protection, patent, and
intellectual
property protections. Because we think, because I went and took a photo of a giraffe in Etosha, my photo with my camera is now public information for the whole Namibia. No, it is not. I drove there with my car, with my petrol, paid my $50 at the gate at Etosha to get in as a visitor, used my $5,000 camera, which is still cheap in terms of that price tag.
Oh, really cheap.
And I took the photo there
at
risk of my own safety because I don't know where the lions are. But yeah, I took my photo with my camera.
Mm.
Now, you can go and take that photo and put it on, what's that international photo thing? Shutterstock. And you can sell that photo continuously on that platform because you took it, Hamoud. You took it. No one else did. So that does not mean, because the park is there, the park is open to the public, it does not mean that the photo you generate through your own efforts and endeavors and investments also is public ownership. No. I don't know where people got this idea that because I am measuring something in public, my activity of
measurement. I must give you the information.
My activity of measurement is
just free of charge. There you have it.
It's just like that. Free of charge. I don't know who told Namibians this rubbish. I don't know who told them. Look, Helmut.
That's taking Ubuntu to a whole another level.
It's not even that. It's just understanding that thing that you asked the question of, when we see such faux pas by ministries, officers, and agencies of the government. A faux pas, dear listeners, is like an egregious mistake. Okay, I'm actually adding a lot of extra onto the mistake aspect. But it is an error so big, it technically, you know, becomes like the talk of the town.
Yeah.
A faux pas
is literally, with a bit of French being, you know, adding a little bit of French into this discussion, a faux pas literally says, makes it sound even worse, but comical, which you and I we were doing because we were laughing because we couldn't realize how comical this particular set of events were, because it was comical. And nonetheless, when we look at these particular discussions, look, Helmut, if someone says, let's say you go and approach a girl that you like. She knows that you like her because you told her you like her.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell her, listen, now that I've announced or confessed to you that I like you, can I kiss you? And she says, near. She says, no. Now, I mean, in some cases, I hope for some of you guys, you accept the no.
Yep.
You accept the no. Because what can you do? You can't control the other person.
Yeah, yeah.
If the person says, no, I don't want to, then there you go. The person said no. Unless you get the weird communication style that other friend of mine we just heard from the other girl who said, no, I want you to pursue me tomorrow. Come back tomorrow and pursue me some more. I was like, but you said no yesterday. What must I do today? But nonetheless, I'm mixing, two subjects here. But nonetheless, yeah.
Someone postponed the pursuing. Seriously? Okay, go on.
We were laughing in our second year because this one classmate of ours was like, no, I want you to come back tomorrow. And we told her, but you said,
see,
no.
Again, right. Those are the people that I always ask the question of, can I have your supplier's number, please? because that's the most irrational thing. You say no today. What am I going to come back?
What will change tomorrow?
Exactly.
No, I want you to pursue me. Why must I pursue you if you said no? Now I must look like the stalker.
You do realize that's how people end up with a restraining order.
Yeah, that's most why I said, now I look like the stalker.
Yeah, and I don't want to have that label.
Yeah. If you said no, effort has been... I made economic choices. Mm-hmm. I either walked there or I used cab or I jumped on my bicycle. In between, I expended energy just to go and ask you while you were just standing at home with your rollers in your hair.
And your answer is no, come back tomorrow.
No, just no. Not even why. Because you know you can't even demand the why. Why are you saying no? Mm-hmm.
Because I can't say no because, well,
you own the right. You own the right.
Yeah.
Scenarios like that, yeah. So as we're heading into the last 10 minutes, dear listeners, these June meetings, besides the add-on that Helmut and I put in the middle in terms of how do their brains work? In making decisions in some of the big offices of this country.
Media pressure will get you into trouble.
But Helmut, it's also like the kind of discourse that erupts around, like, for example, some media reports. Helmut, to be honest, I remember that story.
The airport.
Yeah. I was the guy that took the money of the company to place the ad.
Oh, no.
Because they hired a lawyer. They hired a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
They showed up at the company. It was a Chinese company.
Yeah.
They showed up at the company that I worked at. And they asked to place this notice of their reply verbatim as an advertorial on the Monday publication. Because the story came out the Thursday or the Wednesday. That story. And they wanted to set the record straight with telling their perspective as a company.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they laid out the facts in terms of that they bid. There was a bid opened.
Mm-hmm.
They submitted a bid.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the successful because they could prove track record in terms of working on such a scale. Now, I would have at least loved to have seen that project, that 8 billion Namibian dollars,
mm-hmm.
come to fruition for the investment into Dosia Kutaku International Airport.
Yeah.
Instead of seeing... That 8 billion being broken up into small pieces. Because that's most technically what happened since 2018, this way.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember we were this close to being blacklisted by IATA. IATA is the International Aviation Transport Authority. So there is ICAO, ICAO, and there's IATA, IATA.
Okay, and the blackmailing threat was because
no,
of the
not
standard.
Blackmailing. It was also a blacklisting.
Not blackmailing. Oh, that's a Jeffrey Epstein thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so.
yeah.
So the blacklisting.
The blacklisting was because our airport was so old.
It was not up to standard.
And was not up to standard. And
it sounds like our, you know, I think FIFA should, you know, threaten us the same way. We'll just quickly.
No, but we have been threatened. That's why we're playing in Botswana now.
So if we had an option of taking our national airlines before it, was basically, well,
if we had
dissolved
an option.
In us, if we had an, you know, an option of taking it to Botswana in South Africa, we would have done so.
Yes, but it just shows, it just shows primarily that we don't know how to deal with an asset.
Just keeps getting more and more painful.
Helmut, here's the thing, and this is the particular, before we end, which is about 5 minutes away. If you look at, for example, like the stadium renovations.
Yeah.
To date, 3 years since City of Windhoek, 3 years or 2.5 years, 2 years to date, City of Windhoek entertained engineers at Sam Nyoma Stadium. Before then, if you add on the time before then, by when we were blacklisted for playing at home, it would have been in 2023. 2023. So if you count from 2023 to 2026, technically, it's 3 years. Mm-hmm. And we still have not gotten a nail going and a paint job going at Sam Nyoma Stadium. You look at Independence Stadium. The stadium has been the same since whenever it was built. The same. The only things that changed probably is that they replaced the old design of plastic seats with the new design of plastic seats, you know, the bucket seats here in the main stand.
Yeah.
That's the only thing. And probably refurbishing whatever is up there in the VIP booth area. Yeah. That's it. Still the same facade 100 years later. In essence, we don't take infrastructure serious. In essence, we don't take infrastructure serious. HD was with me at that press conference last year where before the previous minister, Agnes Chongorero, was it last year or the year before, 2024? I think it was 2024. Where Agnes unveiled the project engineer and, you know, the planned first phase discussion. The first phase was just assessing and then starting certain particulars like needed work. We weren't told what will actually change of Independence. We weren't told because we were still at phase one.
Yeah.
We were still at phase one. Now, obviously, back in last week or the week before, Namibians saw that before work has actually begun, there's a whole bunch of money to pay that engineering consultants.
Of course.
For work that they've already done. Mm-hmm. So they've done pre-assessment work. Now that bill needs to be settled before they can actually start then. Now I'm going to ask you, Helmut, with the denim blue eyes that I don't own in my life, probably somewhere there in a recessive gene somewhere. On the German, on the European side of my genealogy and DNA. We want our sport to reach a level. Why is it taking three years just to know what we must fix?
Well, we know what to fix.
No, we don't know what to fix, Helmut. We know what FIFA said.
Yeah.
And what CAF said, FIFA said through CAF.
Yeah.
You are not onto standard. International hosting standard.
Yeah.
So we wanted to go and host, what's that thing's name? AFCON with Botswana.
AFCON with Botswana.
We would have already been denied because the stadiums were not on the level.
Yeah.
Or we probably, this is my
spit. I mean, they don't make sense now.
This is my spitballing theory. We probably backed out of that bid because we probably knew
we had a sneaky suspicion.
You guys are not understanding. So we knew. We were told in 2022 when we backed out.
So the same thing can be, take for example, Is it the same thing with I forgot one example on my example of scientists, of public officials, aka government officials, not listening to experts.
Yeah.
Scientists have been telling since I think 1998, the South African government, you have to expand your power generation source.
Yeah.
Because the source that you spend on that you depend on right now, first of all, was built in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And it was built for for mostly the mining industry.
Yeah.
Now, it was not built with a democratic dispensation that took place after 1994 in mind to cater for the entire South African population. They didn't listen until 2008 when load shedding started.
When Eskom had to go like, you know what, guys?
Yeah, I think you were right.
And before we continue, guys, we quickly take a night break.
Actually, wrap up on the other side.